case number 11-3054 et al. United States of America versus Anderson Straker, also known as Gypsy Sun, also known as Andy, appellant. Case number 11-5124, Zion Clark et al. Appellant versus Eric H. Holder Jr., Attorney General, U.S. Department of Justice, and Jeffrey Charles Taylor, United States Attorney for the District of Columbia. Issue number 11-3054 et al., United States of Stryker. Citizenship of Mr. Marahaja. Ms. Killian for the appellants, Mr. Goodhand for the appellees.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Before you begin, I understand there are quite a few lawyers who would like to argue in this case today, and what we will do is after the third argument, which I think is a 404B issue, we will pause. We won't recess. We'll just take a pause so you can all switch seats, and those of you who are sitting further back can move up to counsel table, okay?
Thank you, Judge Tatel. We appreciate that. May it please the Court, my name is Victoria Killian. I'm with the law firm of Arnold & Porter, and we represent the appellant, Kevon Demereau, in this appeal. I will be presenting the first issue today on behalf of all appellants. May I please reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal? In describing the constitutional guarantee of a meaningful opportunity to present a complete defense, Justice O'Connor wrote for a unanimous Supreme Court that an essential component of procedural fairness is the opportunity to be heard. Defendants have evidence that tends to negate the U.S. national element of the offenses for which they are serving life imprisonment. The district court ruled that a denaturalization hearing was the exclusive forum in which to present this evidence. To date, that forum has not been available to defendants. The only forum defendants had, Your Honors, was their trial, where the government bore the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that Trinidad national Balram Maharaj was a U.S. citizen. Defendants had a legal basis to make this argument that was their defense. As the Third Circuit stated in Rosenberg versus United States, the certificate of naturalization, when procured by fraud, is a paper fraud and conferred at the time of its grant no right whatsoever upon the claimed citizen.
Could you just, would you just focus directly on the district court's reasoning for us here? The district court said the statute refers to naturalized citizen, to a naturalized person. That means citizen. The victim had a certificate of naturalization. This is the district court's reading. Had a certificate of naturalization. The Supreme Court has said again and again that that's conclusive, and that the only way to challenge that is a 1451 proceeding. So what's wrong with that reasoning?
Yes, Judge Tatel, yeah. We believe that that reasoning should not apply in the context of a criminal trial because the documentation should not be held to be conclusive in that instance, and defendants should be able to present evidence that it was void from the outset.
I couldn't find a case that supports that. Is there one? I didn't see one in your brief either.
We do not have a case, right, Your Honor, where the issue was dealt with in a criminal trial where the defendant was trying to assert a right to a defense based on the void ab initio principle. But we note that the void ab initio principle, Your Honor, is not unique to the denaturalization context, and indeed it is not even unique to the immigration context. And if I may, Your Honor, the BIA applies the void ab initio principle in the context of determining whether persons are lawful permanent residents. Defendants cited in their brief at pages 14 and 15 the case of Gallimore versus Attorney General, which is a Third Circuit case from 2010. That case adopted the reasoning of the BIA. There was a factual issue that was remanded in that case, but the Third Circuit stated that a lawful permanent resident status procured by fraud was void ab initio, and it did not rely on the denaturalization statute to apply that principle.
Well, can I ask you about, I mean, we do have a relevant case on point, and that would be the Costello case from the Supreme Court. First, am I correct in understanding that your claim turns on the assumption that the retroactivity language, the backwards-looking language of 1451, is going to apply to the word national in 18 U.S.C. 1203? Is that correct?
I think we would characterize our claim, Your Honor, as that defendants had a right, based on their constitutional right to present a defense, to bring a defense unless there is some legitimate basis to exclude that evidence. And the court's basis was that the evidence was irrelevant. We think that's a fairly low threshold, and we think where this principle has been applied in context outside of 1451, the jury should have been able to apply it here.
Well, you have the right. I'm sorry. I think your defense was to disprove the word, the nationality, the national status in 18 U.S.C. 1203. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You're trying to prove that you were trying to cast reasonable doubt on whether he was a national in that regard. And so that requires us to ask what the word national means in that statute. And tell me how I'm misreading Costello. Costello seems to me at least to suggest that the backwards operation, what you call void ab initio principle of 1451, does not apply to criminal statutes, and the criminal statutes simply look at the status at the time of the offense.
Your Honor, I wouldn't say that you're misreading Costello, but I would say that I think its holding was a little bit more narrow than what you described. In Costello, the Supreme Court was interpreting the deportation provision of Section 241, and the court found it very compelling that that provision had a safeguard in the second section of the statute, which only an alien could apply. So, for example, the court hesitated to apply the void ab initio principle to read into 1451, that void ab initio principle extended to the deportation context, because that would produce some anomalous results for the person who was going to be deported in that case. For example, this individual was a 73-year-old man who had lived in the United States since he was 4 years old.
I mean, we may not have the same anomalous results, but we certainly have anomalous consequences here, that the person who's being whom you wish to show was not a national, or by proof beyond a reasonable doubt was not a national.
That's right.
Is no longer with us, is not able to defend himself, is not able to receive the notice that the 1451 process requires, and we don't have any idea what kind of options, alternative routes, means of addressing the issues that you all want to raise, he might have been able to come forward with. So why isn't that at least parallel to the concerns they had in Costello?
I don't think it's parallel, Your Honor, because in this situation, we are not asking, at least in the context of wanting to put on this evidence in the trial, we are not asking to denaturalize Mr. Maharaj. So the jury's determination in the criminal trial would not have any effect on citizenship until that citizenship is revoked beyond the bounds of that proceeding.
But Ms. Killen, you're saying it seems to me that sort of highlights a tension in your position. You're saying you're not seeking to denaturalize him, and yet the non-pro-tunk quality, the void ab initio quality that you are seeking to invoke is provided under the denaturalization statute. So it sounds like you're trying to avoid it because if you're seeking denaturalization, there's an exclusive process for that, and you want to not be remitted exclusively to that process. But you're also trying to deploy a part of that legal standard here in the criminal case. And I'm just not sure how you can have that both ways.
Well, if I may, Your Honor, there is a case discussed in the Gallimore case, which we cited at 14 and 15, and we did not cite this case separately, but I think it might help to flesh out this idea that we're trying to apply. And that case was In re Colomantangi, which was a BIA decision from 2003. The citation is 23 INN DEC 548. In that case, there was a man who obtained his lawful permanent resident status, so he was not naturalized. And he obtained that status by fraud. It was contingent upon his marriage. And it turns out he was married to somebody else already. And so the BIA was going to deport him. And at the time of that deportation proceeding, the individual said, look at the BIA regulations. You cannot deport me because the BIA regulations say that I have LPR status until the order of deportation. And so the court in that case looked at the regulations and said, that regulation is inapposite because we have held for a long time that when you procure your citizenship, your LPR status by fraud, it is void from the outset. And so the court in that situation, the BIA, the administrative body, the BIA, overlooked that provision of the regulation in order to apply the void ab initio.
But again, relation back language apply within immigration proceedings seems quite different to me than what the Supreme Court said in Costello, and that is it's not going to cross over into criminal laws. Right? Was that crossing over into a criminal? BIA doesn't hear criminal cases. The issue here is whether or not that relation back language in 1451 was intended by Congress to operate on the word national in 18 U.S.C. 1203. And so is there something in the text of 1451 or 1203 that you can point me to, or precedent or legislative history that shows Congress intended national in the criminal statute to have that same type of meaning?
No, I don't think that there's anything in the legislative history of 1203 that addresses this issue. The hostage-taking statute was enacted because the United States had signed on to the International Convention, International Hostage-Taking Convention, and so the United States had an obligation to enact this statute. And I haven't seen anything in the legislative history that would specifically say that the void ab initio principle could apply or that it wouldn't. But I note that the statute was enacted after this body of case law developed about void ab initio.
But it was also developed, obviously after Costello, where the Supreme Court said if there's nothing in the history of the statute or the text of the statute, we're not going to transport the relation back principle into a criminal statute. Isn't that the more likely thing that Congress would have relied on?
Well, I actually don't think that the Supreme Court in Costello was just resting its decision on the absence of legislative history. I think the court was looking at the statutory language of the deportation provision and noting that it wouldn't make sense to apply the void ab initio principle here because the person who is going to be deported in that case would not be able to avail himself of
the protections. And why does it make sense to have it apply here to this particular statute, which is very much concerned with the ability of the United States to protect people, its own citizens, who are citizens at the time it seeks to protect them when they're overseas?
Well, I think in general, the United States has to have a basis to extend extraterritorial jurisdiction. And here, the basis is written into the statute. And so the only way this case has jurisdiction in the United States is if Mr. Maharaj was a U.S. national, and the government is taking the position that that means that he was a citizen. That's one way you can be a U.S. national. I do think that defendants, as a matter of their right to present a defense, should be able to invoke this principle because it has a basis in the law and because the certificate of naturalization and the passports would not necessarily be conclusive. And I think
except that the court has said the certificate of naturalization is conclusive. I mean, the Supreme Court has said that again and again. You're right about the passports, but the district court allowed you threw out one of the passports and allowed you to challenge the other one.
Well, right? Your Honor, I think that the court has also allowed for prior determinations to be, in a sense, collaterally attacked in criminal trials. And we cited the case of U.S. versus Mezzasoria That was a Ninth Circuit case from 1991, but it also discussed the Supreme Court case of United States versus Mendoza-Lopez, which is 481 U.S. 828 from 1987. There, the Supreme Court allowed the defendant to challenge a prior deportation order. The element of the offense was that he was deported, and they were allowing him to challenge the order of deportation. And I think that's significant because in the Mendoza-Lopez case, the rationale for allowing him to challenge that order was because there was an allegation that the deportation proceedings were not conducted in accordance with due process. And if I may...
Yeah, go ahead, because you're well over your time, and I was going to suggest we move on and hear the government.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Do you want to finish your sentence?
Sure. I just wanted to note that in the Mendoza-Lopez case, the court said that it was the precisely the unavailability of effective judicial review of the administrative determination at issue that sets that case apart.
Okay.
Here, the defendants did not have an opportunity to have judicial review of the conclusion that there was a naturalization decision until their trial, and we thought they should have a forum to do that.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Goodhand.
May it please the Court, David Goodhand for the United States. The district court judge got this right when he decided that the jury could decide whether or not the victim was a citizen at the time of the hostage taking, but not whether or not the victim should have been a citizen. And in that respect, the district court finally hewed the evidentiary presentation precisely as was appropriate, given the exclusive procedures of 8 U.S.C. 1451. And, you know, by way of analogy, I think what we're talking about here is not that unusual. We've cited to some cases in our brief, for example, in the felon in possession context, this kind of thing happens a fair amount. That is, there's an adjudication of whether or not somebody's status is what it is at the time of, in the felon in possession cases, at the time of the possession. In this context, we're talking about status at the time of the hostage taking. In the felon in possession cases, it's every day in federal courts.
Right. Those are helpful, Mr. Goodhand, except the felonies are proved beyond reasonable doubt. And here the issue is that you have an administrative proceeding where the qualifications for naturalization are not proved beyond reasonable doubt. And there's just some concern that we don't usually take civil legal determinations as conclusive in a criminal case for reasons of the standard.
It is true. From my perspective, the analogy to the federal felon in possession goes only so far as to the collateral attack feature of this case. But in terms of beyond a reasonable doubt, the jury did find beyond a reasonable doubt that this man's status at the time of the hostage taking in 2005 was a citizen. And they were allowed, the defendants were allowed to adjudicate whether or not he had possession of a forged, for example, passport or certificate.
I think that's helpful. I think the distinction you made when you stood up is a helpful one, that the statute is asking, was the person a citizen, not should he have been a citizen. Is that a question of statutory intent, sort of congressional intent behind 1203? Is that how we should conceptualize it? And if so, what additional evidence do we have that this is more like, this is a Schedule I narcotic or this is a designated terrorist organization versus this is someone who is really eligible to be a citizen of the United States?
I think the best evidence is by looking at how the statute, 1203, that is, 1203 defines national by referring the reader back through the immigration statutes, and in particular 8 U.S.C. 1101A22, and says, look, a national is a citizen or somebody who's sworn allegiance. So my point is, in that respect, Judge Bates, I think, was quite prescient when he said, look, there's an exclusive process by which we can determine whether or not somebody is indeed to be denaturalized. And I think 1203, by putting this through that process by its definition of national, it suggests that that's the way we are going to go. And Judge Bates, I think, appropriately considered that.
Suppose it was totally clear from the record, completely, unquestionably clear, that this victim was not eligible for citizenship? I mean, suppose, for example, he lied on his application form about whether he'd ever been convicted of a crime of moral turpitude, and he said no, and he, in fact, had been convicted of child rape. So it was crystal clear that had the AG known, this person would never have gotten a certificate.
Assuming, obviously, we don't agree with that in our case.
That's why I started my question with the word suppose.
Okay, I will suppose that it is crystal clear.
Yeah.
I would suggest would be taken into account when we are assessing whether or not to pursue this prosecution.
I thought you might say that. So, you know, there's a very sort of Kafkaesque element to this, which is that, and I understand the government's, the logic of 1451 and your argument. I got all that. But your position is that we know, you can see the government has to prove that the victim was a U.S. national, correct? That's an element of the crime.
Absolutely.
Yet in my hypothetical, the only way the defendant can disprove that is by convincing the very government that's prosecuting him to initiate a denaturalization proceeding. That's just not the way the criminal system works in this country.
Well, I know that my analogy to felon in possession is somewhat imperfect, but...
Well, what about my question?
Well, I'm trying to answer it to the extent that I'm just suggesting that if you have a conviction at the time you decide to possess a gun, that's the end of the matter. It's the fact of the conviction. It's the fact of that legal status.
Uh-huh. Is that true? What if you had been convicted under a patently unconstitutional... You were convicted of speaking in the public square. And we know that our Constitution can't even recognize that as a conviction. There's no dispute. And for whatever reason, the prosecutor chooses not to take that into account in bringing the prosecution. What would the defendant do then?
My understanding of the case law in that context is that if the defendant had wanted to go about owning a gun at the time that he had a conviction, he would have had to preemptively move in his jurisdiction to have that vacated as an unconstitutional conviction. Mm-hmm. But a district court judge in the context of 922G can't look behind that conviction. Mm-hmm. That can't be collaterally
attacked.
And
what if you had a statute that Congress had separately passed that said... in a civil context, that to avoid a civil fine for possessing a firearm. So there's a criminal and a civil one. And the civil one said, if the felony conviction is unconstitutional, it shall be void ab initio. It will be as if it never happened. Over here we know that Congress thinks these things don't count. And so why don't I get to prove in the criminal case that these things don't count, too?
Again, I think it's the status that is vested upon the legal order, and we won't look behind that.
There's two big differences between my hypothetical and the gun case. In the felon in possession case, the defendant, assume you're right, that you can't challenge it. The defendant could have challenged that himself. He could have argued that in a different proceeding maybe, that the felon in possession conviction was flawed for some reason. He had the power to do that. But in this case, in this situation, the government's position is the only way to question the legitimacy of the naturalization certificate is for the government to initiate proceedings. In other words, the defendant has to convince the government to do it. And you have an affidavit here from Mr. whatever his name is that you never do this when the person whose citizenship is being questioned is deceased.
That's to my mind, that makes perfect sense. When you look at denaturalization, when you look at what the Supreme Court cases have said about the significant adverse detrimental consequences attendant that, the stigma, all the adverse consequences, Your Honor.
But all of those, you're right about that. I don't mean to interrupt you. But all of those statements, none of those statements come in the context of the situation we face here, where we also have at stake the rights of a criminal defendant. Correct?
Yes, but... Okay. My point is, look, we do this all the time to the extent that We give a criminal defendant the right to pursue his defense to a point, but when it becomes irrelevant or there's an exclusive procedure for taking away the status that hasn't been followed here, you know, the Supreme Court says in Scheffer, that's not taking away their right to present a defense. It's just saying that there are certain lines we draw.
Yeah. But the difficulty here is that you didn't draw that line.
I'm sorry?
You didn't really draw that line. You said, jury, you, and criminal defendant, you do get to challenge whether he's a national. You do get to invite the jury to find reasonable doubt about his status as a citizen. But you only get to do that by looking at these few pieces of evidence, the passport and the certificate. But you don't get to bring in your big gun evidence. So it's not as though you recognize that this is not something for the jury to decide at all. You're just letting them, you know, peek around the corner but not pull back the curtain.
Well, that's, to my mind, that's a distinction between law and fact. I mean, all the time, judges...
No, if it's law, you don't get to peek around the corner at all. It's just the judge decides it.
And so that's exactly what the judge was deciding here.
Well, so there is. It seems like there is a little bit of a conflict in the way that this was treated, and there was some discussion in the district court opinions about whether the judge had effectively awarded a directed verdict. And I guess one question is, why wouldn't the judge have directed the verdict on the citizenship element, given that there wasn't the kind of evidence of, like, defaced passport or you know, fraudulently doctored naturalization certificate? There wasn't any of that kind of evidence. So really there wasn't a jury issue on the citizenship, was there?
I think he could have, honestly. I think he could have, to the extent that he drew the line and said, look, if you can show that this guy ginned up his certificate of naturalization in his basement with some bad paper and some stamps he had down there, you, the defendant, if you can show that to the jury, then what we have is a forged certificate of naturalization. That's a different question.
What do you mean could have? I don't understand could have. Either it's a legal question or it's a fact question. Now, clearly you would let them decide identity. You know, is a person named here, the person on the certificate, the person that's sitting in the defendant's chair. Or maybe they could dispute authenticity, some of that. But it went more than that, and you didn't object to the jury instruction that said to the jury, you may consider the certificate evidence of nationality. If it's a legal question, I think the position of the United States government is ordinarily that it doesn't go to the jury at all.
Well, frankly, I think the defendant's got a benefit in that respect when they said...
But did you tell the court that this is a legal question, it shouldn't go to the jury at all?
We told the judge that the legal question of whether or not he should have been deemed a citizen in 1995 was not something for the jury to adjudicate. We also told the judge that the jury could adjudicate whether or not he actually possessed the indicia of citizenship on the back end of that process in a non-forged fashion. That's the distinction. And this gets to the...
But why do we let the jury make that distinction? Well, but it sounded like they got to decide the citizenship issue.
No,
partway.
I would agree with that to the extent that they got to decide whether or not this guy forged his naturalization certificate. And if not, then frankly, I think getting back to Your Honor's earlier question, if the jury had concluded he had not forged that, it was an authentic certificate of naturalization, I think, frankly, the judge could have taken away from it.
No, thereafter. Right. So that's not, okay. So that's if you're saying that what the jury gets to decide are either authenticity or identity, those two aspects, that makes sense to me. But that's not how I understood the jury instruction here, and it's not how I understood your briefing, which seemed to trumpet the fact that, oh, they got to argue citizenship to the jury. We just let them argue it part way.
I apologize if my briefing was unclear, because I think this falls precisely in, for example, the Zapata case we cited out of the Ninth Circuit. You know, the jury can't adjudicate whether a federal tribe has been properly designated by the Bureau of Indian...
That's pending on bank right now, right?
That is true. It is absolutely true. But I think the thinking is exactly the same.
So, Mr. Goodham, am I right? And I've been trying to think of analogs, and obviously close ones would be, you know, threatening the life of the president. You wouldn't get a chance to say, well, the president wasn't born in the United States, and therefore he's not eligible to be president, and therefore I wasn't threatening the life of the president. You take the status as of the time. That seems like a relatively easy analog. Is this case also analogous to, for example, the notion that we don't allow a criminal defendant in a narcotics case to challenge whether a particular substance should have been Schedule I, that, you know, we don't let them go into the administrative process and say, well, this isn't really a threat to the public, and therefore, you know, it doesn't meet the criteria, and therefore I've been deprived of a defense, or is that...
I think that's a variation on this theme. Just as we don't let a defendant come into court and say, the legislature wrongly determined this was a crime of violence, and so you can't hook me up for a 924C conviction based on that crime of violence. We don't let the defendants go behind those sort of other jurisdictional determinations, the BIA, the legislature making a crime of violence determination. I apologize, I'm well over.
You're well, we took you well over. Unless my colleagues have no further questions. Well, Ms. Killian, you...
I apologize, just one quick question. So what does the relation back language in 1451 apply to?
If a 1451, as I understand it, if a 1451 court properly convened determines that that naturalization certificate was procured by fraud, then it goes back to the date of the procurement, the fraudulent procurement.
So if it happened tomorrow, would that vitiate a prosecution under 1203, or are the definitions different?
It would not vitiate a prosecution because that determination, it's the difference between voidable but void.
You said it would not?
It would not. It's a difference between voidable but void. If a 1451 court had determined before this offense had unfolded that this man was not a citizen, then that would be the end of the matter. And that gets back to Judge Tatel's question, you know, what would you do if you had been told that this man was not, you know, he had wrongly...
What about, suppose it happens now?
If it happens now, it does not undo the conviction.
How do you get there?
Under the plain language of the statute.
Because at the time of the offense...
Why doesn't it go back to the time when it was issued?
I'm sorry. At the time of the offense, he had a valid certificate of naturalization.
1451 says no, that this goes back in time and everything disappears. So it turns out he wasn't.
Right.
Well, again, this, I guess if you disagree with me on this, I think this gets back to Costello's point, which is that in the criminal context, we're not going to apply that relation back
provision. I'm trying to figure out exactly what 1203 means by national, when you have to have it, at the time of the offense, at the time of the indictment. What if it happened between offense and indictment? What would your position be?
If it happened between the offense and the indictment, that would be a tougher call because again...
I'm just trying to figure out what the word means in the statute.
Well, I know you don't like my felon in possession analogy, but if a conviction is vacated after the defendant owns the gun, you don't go back and undo that felon in possession.
But you don't have plain statutory language like you do here.
Mm-hmm. And the plain statutory language...
is asking you about the language in the statute.
Right.
And so to get around that, you have to embrace Costello, right?
No.
But you don't?
No. 1203...
That explains why you didn't discuss it in your brief, right?
I didn't discuss it in my brief because it was an oversight and I am human.
No, I'm just curious. I just assumed it wasn't... You didn't think it was necessary to your argument. I wasn't criticizing your brief.
No.
There's a lot of stuff in your brief that I'm sure you didn't put in for quite good reason, and I just assumed that you didn't think it was necessary.
My take on the language of the statute is 1203. 1203 says if you are a national at the time of the offense.
It doesn't say that.
It doesn't say that. You're reading a different statute.
It says if you are a national.
It is a national, but it doesn't say when. And 1451 tells us that for some things, but I don't know what. I'm trying to find out for what. It undoes things retroactively. It works backwards in time to undo citizenship status. And I'm just trying to understand from the U.S. government when it does that, what it does that for, if not for criminal statutes. Since 1203 doesn't give us a time.
I apologize, I'm being unclear. My point is that if a 1451 proceeding had been convened and adjudicated before this indictment or even this charge or even this offense, that this man had procured that fraudulently, then we wouldn't be having this discussion. But even if that's done after the conviction, that does not void that conviction.
The statute says any revocation, quote, shall be effective as of the original date of the certificate. That's what the statute says. Shall be effective as of the original date of the certificate.
And nothing in 1203 walks away from that. Right. Gives us a time limit.
Again, 1203 says if you are a United States citizen when the hostage taking unfolds.
It doesn't say when. It just says it's a crime to take someone a hostage if that person is a national, but it doesn't tell us when that is operates, whether it's the time of the offense, the time of the indictment, or it is simply a requirement for a valid conviction.
It says it is not an offense if the conduct occurred outside the United States unless the person seized is a national of the United States. And our core point is that this person seized was a national of the United States at the time he was seized.
I guess
that's what
answer,
I thought your argument
did,
was.
Did you
brief.
Have an answer to Judge Millett?
Right.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
About what is the operation of the relation back language? I mean, I assumed that it was in the context of, for example, you know, a naturalized citizen has a child during a period of putative naturalization, and the child then, by you know, being the child of a naturalized citizen, has citizenship rights. But if that is if the parent is denaturalized and there's a relation back, that would also affect the citizenship status of the child. And so, I would think that those would be core operations of that language. But I didn't hear from you any examples.
I think that's what the statute is getting at. If there are derivative benefits attendant the naturalization of the citizen.
I got to beg to differ because there's Section D addresses that in the statute, so it would be entirely surplusage to have it in A. D already addresses derivative citizenship, so I really am trying to figure out what it applies to.
Well,
how do we know it doesn't apply?
I think that its operation relates to if you have features of citizenship, perhaps beyond derivative citizenship for your offspring, that were obtained fraudulently via your fraudulent application, then those would be taken away by the 1451 operation.
Okay. All right. Anything else?
No.
Okay. Let's see. Ms. Killian, I think you used up all your time, or maybe we used it all up. Would you like to take 2 extra minutes?
Your Honor, just so I could address the point about the felon in possession cases and the like, I think those cases are clearly distinguishable, and the United States Supreme Court thinks so too. In the case I was discussing, Mendoza-Lopez, the court distinguished the felon in possession cases. There was one, the Lewis versus United States, and it said it is precisely the unavailability of effective judicial review of the administrative determination at issue here that sets Mendoza-Lopez apart from the felon in possession cases. So I agree. I think that those cases are clearly distinguishable because here defendants did not have any judicial review thus far of the naturalization determination.
Judge Pillard's hypothetical to government counsel about the drug prosecution led me to ask a different hypothetical. Suppose somebody's being prosecuted under the federal statute that prohibits lying to a federal official, 1001. Do you think a legitimate defense to that would be that the official lied on his employment application and should never have become an employee?
I think, Your Honor, there would have to be an analogous concept, void ab initio concept, in the case law surrounding those types of cases in order for that to apply.
So then your case turns, your position is that your argument is dependent on the language in the statute that relates the revocation back to the date of issuance. Right?
Actually,
is that your position?
Our position, we're not completely relying on the relation back language of 1451. We're also relying on the case law, Your Honor. And I would note that the BIA continues to use the void ab initio principle in the lawful permanent resident context without relying on the 1451 statute. And so we think the government can't have it both ways. If this principle is a legal fiction. It is one that is alive and well today, and we think we should have been able to apply it in the trial.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you. We'll go on to the civil case. Clark.
Case number 11-5124 et al. Clark v. Holder. All issues. Mr. McCurdy for the appellants, Mr. Nebaker for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
Andrew McCurdy for the appellants. I'd like to try to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The district court foreclosed appellants from any real opportunity to challenge the citizenship element, Section 1203, in any forum before any fact finder. As the panel has just heard, appellants could not present this evidence to the jury at trial. District court stated that instead, appellants must seek to denaturalize Mr. Maharaj through a Section 1451 hearing. Nonetheless, the same district court held that Bahram Maharaj is conclusively a U.S. citizen unless that 1451 hearing occurs. The same district court denied appellant's request to compel the U.S. Attorney's Office to bring such a 1451 hearing.
He held that the defendant lacked a constitutional standing to bring it, correct?
That was one of the holdings, yes.
That's a jurisdictional question. We have to deal with that first, don't we? In other words, if there's no standing, then we don't get to any other issues at all. And so I think we need to start with the district court's conclusion that this was not redressable.
Sure, Your Honor.
And I think the best thing for you to do would be to focus on that. You agree with that, we have to deal with that first?
That's correct.
Okay, fine. So let's start with that.
The district court held that the...
And tell us why, tell us your best argument. And for you to have standing, you have to show that it's likely, reasonably likely, that relief will affect the defendant. And so what is your best argument for why the district court was wrong about that?
First, Your Honor, we need to define what is the injury here. Because appellants were denied the opportunity to present this evidence to the jury at trial, their constitutional right to a complete defense has gone unvindicated. So appellant's injury here is a procedural one, is the lack of an opportunity to be heard on this element of the defense.
Right. But that procedure that you want is of no value to you unless it can have an effect on the criminal case. Right?
That's correct.
So you still have to show a reasonable likelihood that relief here will result in a determination that the victim was not a citizen. Not just that you have a right to the procedure, but that the procedure will yield that result that can be used in the criminal case. You have to show that you have a reasonable likelihood of showing that the initiation of proceedings by the U.S. attorney will result in a decision that the victim was not properly classified as a U.S. citizen. Correct?
In cases like Lujan and Mass v. EPA, the Supreme Court has said that where instances where the injury is procedural, the redressability analysis is relaxed, and the individual does not necessarily have to show that they will receive what they are seeking, just that the procedural injury will be, the procedure will take place. And in this court...
We said in Sargent, I guess you're about to get there, that you don't always have a procedural right unless you have an interest that is protectable by procedure that your client, is due.
And our concrete injury is the conviction under 1203.
And don't you have to get also past the Costello obstacle that we've been discussing on the previous issue, that even if the 1451 proceeding were to find that Mr. Maharaj was should not have been naturalized, is that something that, as a matter of law, would even have an impact? And I understand the U.S. attorney says, no, it wouldn't. What's your response to how Costello would seem to govern that and would seem to say that it wouldn't?
Right. We think Costello is consistent with applying ab initio here. What Costello said, as my colleague was discussing, is that under that deportation statute, because applying ab initio would render this other Section 241B a dead letter, we're going to say we're not sure. A tie goes to the defendant in those cases, so in that instance. So it's a sort of rule of lenity type analysis because deportation is such a drastic remedy. So that same sort of analysis applies here.
I mean, I thought they were pretty clear in Costello that it was a rule of statutory construction, that the relation back principle is unusual, rare, and rare, and we won't assume that Congress intended to import it into other titles of the U.S. Code, absent textual or, back then, legislative history indications. They were pretty explicit about that. Why isn't that the holding that drives us?
Well, court referred to rules of statutory construction. It cited the Feng Wei case to say that deportation is a drastic remedy, so essentially a tie goes to the potential deportee. And what we're saying here is that, first of all, it's not, there's no lack of clarity. 1451 is clear. There's nothing in 1203 that precludes application of ab initio. But even if there was some question, tie goes to the criminal defendant here in favor of applying ab initio.
Can I go back? Judge Pillard, I thought, was asked you about Sargent. Sargent versus Dixon, which the parties, which, right. How do you distinguish that case? I mean, it looks to me pretty close to this case. It was a mandamus action trying to force the government to present evidence to a grand jury. And we said, quote, the fanciful likelihood of success before the grand jury was just too speculative to support standing. Well, how's that different from this case?
If Your Honor isn't inclined to agree that a procedural injury can be redressed in itself.
Well, what about Sargent? Sargent was a procedural claim. They wanted mandamus to force the U.S. attorney to initiate grand jury proceedings. They claimed that was their right.
Here,
you're trying to get the government, the U.S. attorney, to initiate denaturalization proceedings.
District court said on redressability here is that to denaturalize someone is a very high standard. The standard is clear and convincing. Yeah. And because that is such a high standard, there's no way you're going to win in 1451. So that was an error, Your Honor. Yes, at the very least, take some preliminary stock of our good cause affidavit and consider the evidence to determine what is the likelihood that we could win.
Well, we could look at that. I mean, yes, and I want to ask you about that, but just stick with Sargent for a minute. So is your distinction between this and Sargent is that it's not fanciful here, that your evidence is stronger? Is that the point?
That's my point.
That's the distinction. Okay. Well, one of your major pieces of argument is, one of your major arguments in your affidavit, I think, is that he lied about whether he was ever convicted of a crime of moral turpitude, right?
May I set forth our best arguments, Your Honor?
Sure, of course.
Sure. I'll give you two. There are several bases that we set forth. There's two that we think the court should look to first, and that's on the illegal procurement prong of Section 1451. And one is that you need to meet the procedural prerequisites for becoming a naturalized citizen.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you've illegally procured your nationalization. And one is having good moral character.
Okay.
There's several reasons why Balwar Mahars did not have good moral character, including physical abuse of his ex-wife's, conviction of for petty larceny, habitual drunkenness, which...
Okay, but petty larceny under New York law is not a crime of moral turpitude.
Okay, it's a conviction of a crime, so it's one
it's,
thing that
but
the
it's
court...
not a crime of moral turpitude. That's what the question was.
Okay, I guess for a good moral character analysis, the court mm-hmm. has a residual provision under 1101 where mm-hmm. it can consider many different factors about whether the individual had good moral character.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, go ahead. What's your other good argument?
The other argument is that you need to lawfully enter the United States to become a naturalized citizen, Mr. Maharaj did not lawfully enter the United States. He came on a non-immigrant transit visa and then just stayed in the United States, eventually joining the U.S. military, deserting, and was, after that, was ordered to deport and somehow went to Canada and entered with a visa.
I want to understand how you claim your injury, what your injury is and how it would be redressed. Would your injury be redressed just by having this process go forward in some degree, because at some level then you would get to test nationality as you had wanted to in the criminal case? Is that all you need, or is it that if this process goes forward and he's deemed to be a non-citizen, our convictions go away? Which is it?
We have a constitutional right, a procedural due process right to put on our evidence, so I think it's the former. And I point the court to D.C. Circuit.
But I don't, so your position is whether or not he's ever proved to that he should be denaturalized, whether that showing is ever made is irrelevant. You just want the chance somewhere to show somebody that he might not be a citizen.
That's correct. We want our procedure.
How on earth can this procedure possibly satisfy whatever rights you have as a criminal defendant? I just don't understand. I guess I don't understand that argument. This procedure.
Why is it a defense?
Right. It's not to a jury. It's not. You have the burden of proof. The government doesn't have the burden of proof. What I don't understand how this can vindicate whatever constitutional right you may or may not have had to challenge his status, whether he should have been granted this nationality status.
In this instance, where we could not present the evidence to the jury, Your Honor, it is better than nothing to present it through this form.
Is it?
I mean, presumably that you would then want to turn around and present a decision on denaturalization to a jury in the criminal proceeding. You would be arguing that there would have to be a retrial and that you would have to be able to require the jury to find beyond reasonable doubt that this person was a naturalized citizen.
If it was a case that Mr. Maharaj was denaturalized, we believe that we could file a habeas 2255 petition.
And I'm still trying to understand how under Sargent your interest in being heard is cognizable, where our court said that an interest in being heard without a concrete injury that might actually be addressed is not, it's not the kind of interest that our legal system recognizes.
Right. I think I'll answer similar to what I said before, but the concrete injury is our conviction. That's directly related to our ability to put on
a defense.
Okay, so
you have to have a theory of how the conviction is going to be overturned by this.
Well, I would point the court to the sugarcane growers case in this circuit, which said a litigant who alleges a deprivation of a procedural protection to which he is entitled never has to prove that if he had received the procedure, the substantive result would have been altered.
Suppose we don't think this fits comfortably within our procedural standing cases. What's your argument there?
On addressability?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think it's what I mentioned before, that the district court certainly did not take into account our evidence at all, just said the standards are too high, you have no chance of winning. Our evidence should be considered in order to make
that standard. The standard in a denaturalization case, the courts have held, is essentially beyond a reasonable doubt. It's equivalent to beyond a reasonable doubt. And the district court knew that.
That's correct, right? So does that mean there's no chance of winning? We could win. It depends on how good our evidence is.
You haven't talked about the Linda R.S. obstacle. I mean, this is something that, you know, Linda R.S. had some material interest in having the father of her child pursued for child support, but the court said there's no cognizable interest in the prosecution of another. Why isn't your client in the same position here?
Because we have an interest in our day in court. We really, ultimately, our goal is to overturn our conviction. We don't care about the denaturalization. What we want is a right to our constitutional procedure.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you, Your Honor.
please the Court. Mark Nebaker here on behalf of the Attorney General and the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia. We heard twice just now that their concrete injury that they are claiming is the injury in their conviction, and yet I'm looking at the very first page of the text of the brief, or the reply brief that they filed, and it says the injury at issue here is not, however, any conviction, but rather the denial of appellant's right to a complete defense. Well, they got that opportunity for a complete defense if they could establish that Mr. Maharaj was not a citizen at the time of the kidnapping. They failed. The government instead proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he was, in fact,
a citizen. Well, that's not really fair, because their argument is they had a right to go beyond whether or not he had a legitimate or a valid certificate, but to question whether the certificate should have been given. That's the theory of their case.
Their theory is...
You agree they did not get that right in the criminal case.
I think I would have to agree that they did not get to prove the should have been a citizen of the United States.
So that's their argument.
Claimed defense, which is in fact not a defense.
Right.
But...
So you can't respond to their case by saying they did get a full right to put on a right to put on a full defense, because their theory is they had a right to put on a broader defense. You agree they didn't get that right. You disagree that they have that right.
I disagree that it's a defense.
But you agree that they didn't get it. And so now they're arguing here they need the mandamus action in order to put on a full defense.
And keep in mind that they can only get relief if they can establish both that they're entitled to have the hearing and that the hearing actually prevails, and then again, the hearing will have the retroactive effect of denaturalizing Mr. Maharaj. And those are very speculative concepts.
Well, the last isn't, right? That's in the text of the statute.
Well, it's speculative that that would have any effect on the criminal case, especially in light of Costello.
I guess I don't know whether it should be speculative. It should be an answer. Maybe it's not yet answered, but it sure isn't speculative. It's a legal answer to that question. Either it does or it does not transport into 18 U.S.C. It's not a speculative fact thing that you have to show for standing.
Except, of course, that Costello says that they're not going to apply the relation back doctrine beyond the derivative citizenship concept.
Yeah, but then Congress has amended the statute. It has a whole separate provision that addresses derivative citizenship, so I'm back to trying to figure out what 1451 applies to, because it can't be derivative citizenship. Something else must be retroactive.
Well, what the Costello Court said was that we're going to comb the legislative history, and what we found is that it seems to have been put in there to simply codify what case law said. And the case has simply said that for purposes of derivative citizenship, it's going to relate back.
Suppose the affidavit they had in this case contained clear and convincing evidence, including a court order, that the victim had been convicted of child rape.
Our view is it wouldn't make a difference as to whether or not they have a right to come to compel us to...
I'm asking you a standing question.
That does go back to
whether it would be redressable.
It might go to the U.S. Attorney's Office motives in whether or not to bring...
No. Why wouldn't that make it quite clear that if a proceeding were initiated, it would result in denaturalization?
Well...
Totally clear that he was ineligible to be a citizen.
For starters, you'd have to consider whether or not the U.S. attorney decided they wanted to pursue the matter after it was initiated. There was nothing to prevent them after it was initiated
This is a mandamus action, and the district court ruled that they lacked standing because it wasn't redressable, because there was no likely success. There's no likelihood of success. And I was asking you, well, suppose there's not only a likelihood of success, but... slam dunk. That is, that if it was initiated by the U.S. attorney, he would be. Now, maybe it fails for some other reason, but doesn't that solve the standing problem?
Well, I don't know that it does, because even if the U.S. attorney isn't convinced that it's a slam dunk, even if someone else is, the U.S. attorney can abate the proceeding.
Are you telling me that if there's that the U.S. attorney looking, discovering through these proceedings that the victim had been convicted of child rape would think there's some reason not to initiate denaturalization proceedings, other than the fact that he's dead?
I was going to say, one example is if the man is dead.
It's
because it certainly counsels against wasting the government's resources to try and
do that. But we have a criminal defendant's rights at stake here. This isn't an abstract case as to whether the U.S. attorney should go and seek to revoke the citizenship of a person who is dead. The question here is the implications of that.
I'm getting ahead of myself, but I will say that there is no constitutional right to have somebody else denaturalized. And that makes sense.
He isn't arguing that. That's not their argument. Their argument isn't that they have a constitutional right to have someone denaturalized. Their argument is they have a constitutional right to put on a full defense in the criminal case. That's their argument. The district court ruled that they had no standing because there was no likelihood of success.
Well, they had no standing in the civil case to institute some proceeding, and I think that's consistent with the Supreme Court's authorities in the past.
And so I just want to make sure I understand the government's answer to my question. The government's answer to my question is that even if there was clear and convincing evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that he shouldn't have had his, it's still not enough for standing because a U.S. attorney might decide that's not sufficient.
Right, they might decide the man's dead. Why should we waste our resources on that? And if they are forced to institute the proceedings, there's nothing that says in the statute they have to continue to prosecute them.
So what about
if they have to bring people from foreign countries to come and testify, and they're going to get cross-examined because they have animosity against Mr. Maharaj because either they're part of the conspiracy or there was animosity at the child custody hearings. Mm-hmm. There are many reasons why the prosecutor might choose not to go after someone under the circumstances, even if one of the pieces of evidence is strong.
So can I ask you about, in that regard, the U.S. brief, the Solicitor General's brief in the Zucca case in the Supreme Court, in which the other side cited and mentioned in their brief. And that is where the Solicitor General spent about 30 pages telling the U.S. Supreme Court that 1451 is different. And the whole reason Congress put the good cause upon good cause language in there was to have a power in the citizenship to compel the U.S. attorney to bring an action if good cause determined by a court exists. So you don't have that discretion.
I think the U.S. attorney has much discretion, and I think
that's not what the Solicitor General told the U.S. Supreme Court.
Go ahead, you can tell us. We're not bound by what the SG told the Supreme Court.
No,
try it.
I'm trying to figure out what the position of the U.S. is.
I think what I can tell you the position of the United States currently is that there is prosecutorial discretion in these matters, and that they can't be compelled to do them.
The whole purpose of the statute was, you know, people were playing games with naturalization and denaturalization to get people to vote. And so they were trying, the whole reason Congress enacted this statute was to ensure that an executive branch couldn't naturalize a whole bunch of people right before the election. And this would, if there was good cause in the citizenship, allow them to come forward and be a check on that. And so it's a mandatory duty. I mean, ordinarily, I understand your Heckler versus Cheney point. It's just thoughtful people here have read this language very, very differently, and those thoughtful people are from your shop.
Well, I will point out that to go beyond the constitutional standing, you still have to get around prudential standing, and there certainly are not apparently within the zone of interest where they've kidnapped or held hostage or conspired to hold hostage some third party. And I have to point out, if you were able to initiate as a citizen or as a non-citizen, as anybody, if you were able to compel a denaturalization proceeding, imagine how odd it would be if you are being prosecuted under the criminal statute 18 U.S.C. 1203, not because the person you seized was a U.S. national, but because you yourself are a U.S. national overseas. And you would be able to come in and you would be able to file an affidavit with the U.S. attorney saying, hey, I'm a terrible person, I lied to you, and how would we disprove it?
Let's be fair to them, all right? You all brought a prosecution. You all agreed that this guy's status as a citizen is an element to go to the jury.
As of the date,
and then you said, guess what? You don't get to challenge that here. You have to challenge it over there. And then when they went over there, you said, No, you don't get to challenge. How could we let criminal defendants challenge this here? You told him to come over here.
Well, no, what we told him was he would have to go mandamus, but that he didn't have a mandamus claim anyway because of Hector versus Cheney, and because of
no, but so all that stuff about, you know, why would we let criminal defendants come over here and do it is, you know, a little bit.
Well, it would seem absurd that someone could compel us to denaturalize themselves so that they can get out of having committed an offense that we were going to charge them.
The better way would be to just litigate these within the criminal case. Okay.
But not to litigate an issue that's not a defense, not litigate whether you should have been a citizen, but whether you were a citizen. The protections for U.S. citizens.
I guess that begs the question. Ordinarily, that would make sense, the should-would distinction. But when you have a statute that says, if you shouldn't, you never were. And so that's what we're grappling with here. And
right.
I think these arguments are skating right past that problem, and I'd rather confront it head on.
Right. Well, I think that's why the Costello decision makes it pretty clear what the limitations are on the relation back. And it would be odd that you would have somebody that could be convicted and then just by a fluke down the road, the person that they have to, they perhaps,
Well, I'm not sure it's odd. I mean, it's a pretty important principle, I think, of international law that allows the United States government to prosecute a murder that happened in another country is that, you know, the citizenship status is actually very consequential.
Except it shouldn't matter whether or not the status should be what matters. If you're a U.S. citizen, you should be entitled to some protections from being...
status is but again, that's begging the question of what that status means. Does it mean legal status, which 1451 could pull the rug out from under? Or does it mean status at a particular time?
I think it means status at a particular time by virtue of the fact that the statute itself talks about if the person is a national of the United States. And that it seems odd that you would think that that would mean anything other than when the crime was committed. You certainly couldn't convict someone, I would think, of an offense of seizing someone overseas who at the time they seized them was not a U.S. citizen, but then they later became a naturalized U.S. citizen. You certainly couldn't read the statute to allow
all right.
that process.
Mr. Nebaker, thank you. You're well over your time.
Thank you.
I think Mr. McCurry used up all time, but you can take 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. If the court agrees that appellants do have a right to present this evidence somewhere, and appellants cannot present it to a jury, then it must be the case that presenting it through Section 1451 hearing will address that injury in a very real sense. I'll point the court to another context where this has come up before this court is in the government contracts. In a case, CC Distributors versus United States, the government or the court held that plaintiff suffers a constitutionally cognizable injury by the loss of an opportunity to pursue a benefit, pursue a government contract, even though it's not certain that they can't prove that they will win that government contract. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. All right. 404B.
Case number 11-3054 et al., United States versus Straker. Fed R evidence 404B. Mr. Wayne for the appellants, Mr. Goodhand for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. Charles Wayne for the appellant, Wayne Pierre, and I'm arguing 404B issue on behalf of all the appellants. The admission of other bad acts in the trial below, that is the three kidnappings, requires reversal of the convictions for three reasons. First, the government never demonstrated a need for such evidence, and the district court never made such a finding. Second, there was no proper purpose for the admission of such evidence under Rule 404B. And finally, under Rule 403, the probative value of such evidence, which, if any, was substantially outweighed by its prejudicial effect. The evidence of the other three kidnappings that came in was propensity evidence, pure and simple.
Is there a legal requirement that there be a demonstrated need? I thought it just had to be relevant. And then it's subject to 404B and the 403 screen. That's what the district court found, and I'm just interested in your response to that.
Both the Supreme Court and this court have long held that the district court must consider need and whether there are other means of proof available.
Isn't that just wrapped into the 403 analysis, though?
It is one factor in 403. I agree, although at least the Fourth Circuit has said that that need requirement is part of the 404B analysis as well. We cite that to the court in a case called Lighting in our brief. But regardless of whether it's in 403 or 404B, it is critical, as the Supreme Court has made clear for 25 years, and as this court has made clear for longer. The government had no need for this evidence. There were four cooperating witnesses, plus five of the seven defendants made what the government claims were confessions. But the government wanted this evidence for obvious reasons. They wanted to present three victims of these other kidnappings, either in person or by proxy. And this goes to prejudice, and this goes to your point, Judge Pillar. Ms. Raghunanan, one of the kidnapping victims, was blindfolded during her ordeal, could never identify any of the kidnappers, but she testified at length and in graphic detail about the horrors of her abduction and captivity. Moreover, there were many photographs introduced into evidence with regard to her kidnapping. And again, there was no proof whatsoever that any of the seven defendants on trial, or through her, participated in the kidnapping. Similarly, with regard to the Ramadar kidnapping, a man named Timothy Semerath, who negotiated Mr. Ramadar's release, also testified. Again, even though these calls that he had made to the kidnappers were all recorded, he could not identify any of the defendants as the kidnappers of Mr. Ramadar. So he was brought in solely to testify as to Mr. Ramadar's condition when Mr. Ramadar was released. And he testified in detail that Mr. Ramadar seemed near death, he'd been suffering horribly, and that's why he was called. Similarly, with regard to the third kidnapping, this is the Jagdeo kidnapping, they brought in several police officers from Trinidad Tobago for the sole purpose of testifying that, Mr. Jagdeo could not identify, nor could anybody connected with that kidnapping, any of the defendants here. But they brought the police officers in to testify that when Mr. Jagdeo was released, he was dirty, frightened, and appeared ill-treated. So
am I right that the core of your analysis here is just that it was really prejudicial and much more so than probative? Because we have this very lenient rule in U.S. v. Long that views 403 analysis as more of a 404B as more of a rule of inclusion than exclusion, and you know if it seems like if it's relevant to all of the permissible grounds in 404B that we can bring it in, background and formation of the criminal relationship, how these people cooperate together similarly in these past acts. And so really you have to rest your claim here on the 403.
Well, Judge Keller, with all due respect, we do not rest this solely on 403. And in fact, the requirements of Rule 404B are not met. None of the things in Rule 404B, it's not an exclusive list, but nonetheless, they didn't satisfy any of them. So, for example, below, the district judge said that it could come in to complete the story. Again, those are his words. But in the Bowie case, a 2000 decision of this court, Judge Randolph wrote, and Judge Tatel was on the panel, that there is no general complete the story exception to Rule 404B, or an explain the circumstances exception to Rule 404.
Right, I think we can't just sort of take those words out of the air and say complete the story or not complete the story. The question is, in this case, they wanted to show that these folks not only knew each other and had relationships, but that these folks committed crimes together, and not any crime, but kidnapping crimes together, and that they did so in circumstances that were could have rough consequences on the victims, life-endangering consequences for the victims. That's part of what they had to show. And why doesn't this do that?
Your question, Judge Millett, has two parts. The first is with regard to the relationships and how they knew each other. There was plenty of proof as to that. There were four cooperating witnesses, all of whom testified how the defendants knew each other.
Yeah, but the evidence went beyond that. It showed their illegal relationships. And we've held again and again that...
Agreed.
Particularly in a conspiracy case, that's a perfectly appropriate use of 404B evidence.
It's a perfectly appropriate... Right. It's certainly perfectly appropriate, obviously, for the cooperating witnesses to so testify. Mm-hmm. But this gets back to the need point.
Well, sometimes cooperating witnesses are not the most pleasant people for juries to credit. And so it seems to me we've held time and again that, you know, the government has a very high standard of proof, and so we have to let them do what they need to do to meet that standard of proof. And so just saying you had a cooperator there can't be enough to shift the balance under 404B.
I don't disagree with that, Judge Millett, but I would say they had four cooperating witnesses, and they had five, what they claimed were confessions, from five of the seven defendants. So there was no dispute, based on the evidence of record, that the defendants knew each other, and the defendants had long relationships with each other. With regard to the criminal conduct...
Well, the confessions, I guess, as we get to another issue, didn't identify, or weren't supposed to identify, who the other folks were that that person was committing the crimes with. So this is the, you know, this is what actually hooks it all together.
It, well, with respect, it does not. Certainly the cooperating witnesses and the alleged statements, you know, proved the government's case. Why the fact that two or three, with regard to the other kidnappings, with regard to two or three of the seven allegedly participated in one or more of the other three kidnappings, that only goes so far. And it, my point well, is, I mean, it's not necessary, and it's overly prejudicial.
Because, I mean, so the standard here, I think, first was grave abuse of discretion, correct?
That is correct.
And so what, if you had to point to just, I don't want to limit you to two things, but, you know, what key things do you think makes this case different from all the others where no grave abuse of discretion has been found? What is it that makes it different here? What's so special about this one?
In addition to the, okay, sticking with prejudice, mm-hmm. The manner of presentation of the evidence is critical here. Every one of the cooperating witnesses started testifying about the other kidnappings before they got to the kidnapping at issue. They did this in such a way, and the government put on its case in this way, so that the judge was confused on fewer than four occasions as to which kidnapping was being discussed. The prosecutor was confused once.
Right, I just want to make sure I'm clearly, because this is important information I wanted from you. This sounds more like an objection to how the evidence was put in, not the evidence's admissibility. So I'm missing something in what you're saying right now.
Your question went to why is this 404B situation different than other 404B situations? Am I correct?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'm saying what's different here is the way the proof came in, the fact that the judge and the prosecutor were confused, and if the judge and the prosecutor were confused, how can we say with fair assurance that the jury was not confused? In fact, I think we should draw the other conclusion. In addition, this also leads directly to what we call, you know, a variance in the indictment. By bringing in all the other three kidnappings, what happened is this enabled the prosecutor to argue that this was the same, quote, organization or crew that carried out all four kidnappings. The organization had a structure and a leader, the Godfather, allegedly Mr. Pierre. This is the language of organized crime. And what the government did here was portrayed a hierarchical criminal enterprise, and it negated, the judge did give limiting instructions, but that argument negated all those instructions. And it also put the defendants on trial for racketeering, for operating a criminal enterprise, which was not charged in the indictment. And in fact, in the government's brief, they talk about that this was a rotating group of armed henchmen. Well, that fits very nicely within RICO's definition of association in fact, which is exactly what the government was arguing without so specifically stating. That takes it out of the run-of-the-mill 404B cases as well, in addition to the fact that the judge recognized, and by the way, a demonstrative piece of evidence was introduced, and the judge said, this looks like a criminal organizational chart.
Okay.
You know, should I be concerned about prejudice here?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah. Let's see. Was counsel, did he have any time left? Oh, sorry, right. It wasn't
David,
just the district judge who got mixed up.
David Goodhand again from the United States, yes. Your Honor. May it please right. The court. Judge Bates exercised his discretion properly and appropriately and carefully in admitting the three incidents for 404B purposes. In fact, the government wanted four incidents. He said three. The government wanted the Gopal incident, which involved a homicide. He said, no, that's too inflammatory. And the government, and throughout the course of the trial, there's no other way to put it, Judge Bates rode herd over the government, constantly ensuring that this was not something that was too fulsome, too robust, too many details. And there are several instances throughout the course of the trial where the court very carefully said, look, you know, let's keep this to a minimum. And at the end of the day, you know, when we get to the post-trial hearings, the court actually said, you know, it was actually significantly less than the 9 hours total that I had provided you. So in that respect,
why isn't it just enormously prejudicial, as the defendants argue? I mean, if you're just looking at the events of the Maharaj kidnapping, you know, here's a bunch of goofballs, they have an idea, they think they can make some ready money, and it all goes really horribly wrong, versus in the past 6 weeks, we've done this once, twice, three times, and it seems like a very, very different kind of conduct once you put it against the background of these three other events.
Well, it's the nature of a conspiracy, of course. We had two counts in this indictment. One was conspiracy, right. The other was substantive crime. 50% of our indictment related to showing the jury, which is a difficult thing, a tacit agreement. They aren't written down. We have to show the relationships. Why do these people trust each other?
But they're being, you know, driving together in cars, coordinating. You go in, you grab. We've got the clear car. We've got the. I mean, there's a lot of other evidence that's showing. You know, and I'm going to go up and show you where in the woods, and I got that covered. You know, I mean, there's just a lot of other evidence showing agreement, as defense counsel has.
There was other evidence, but again, when we're talking about 404B, we're talking about relevant evidence if it has a tendency to prove the elements of the offense. Here in count one, we had a conspiracy, agreement, voluntary, intentional joining the agreement. Count two, we had the substantive offense. The other three kidnappings very usefully and probatively filled out the contours of that agreement in particular.
Although, as I say, fewer than half of the defendants on trial were even involved in those prior kidnappings, right?
Three out of the seven were.
Two out of seven.
Yes. But a number of the cooperators were involved in those other crimes incidents. And one of what I believe Bowie says, you know, this evidence can be appropriate to corroborate cooperator testimony. 404B doesn't have a limitation on what is relevant evidence. It just says it can't come in if it's propensity evidence. Otherwise, if it has a tendency to prove elements of the offense, then it meets 403, then we're good to go. And that's what the district court quite properly concluded in this context.
I guess the question then is under, maybe the way I phrase it, which is more a 403 question, isn't it? More prejudicial.
Well, that circles back around to the limitations that the district court put on the evidence, that is the time limitations, the robust detail. There were several occasions, I've cataloged them in my brief, where the court sort of leapt out of his chair and said, no, let's not go down this road. You know, there might be some testimony here relating to purported sexual molestation possibility. And the court really was on top of this issue and was very careful with it. And in that context, getting back to whether we can say this was a grave abuse of discretion, it seems very difficult to say that in this context when we have those parameters.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Did counsel have any time left?
No.
You can take 1 minute if you'd like it.
No.
Nope. Okay.
I didn't reserve 2 minutes
before. Oh, but you used it up. Yeah.
I have nothing yet.
Okay.
No,
okay. Why don't we have our musical chairs here as quickly as possible, and we'll go into the co-defendant statements with Thank you.
Continuing with case number 11-3054 et al., United States v. Stryker. Co-defendant statements. Mr. Treister for the appellant, Mr. Goodham for the appellees.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. My name is Andrew Treister. I represent Kevon Demereux, and I will be arguing on behalf of appellants that the neutral pronoun redaction of pretrial statements violated the Confrontation Clause and was inconsistent with Bruton v. United States. The wholesale neutral pronoun redaction in this case, where the redactions obviously point to particular defendants, violates the Confrontation Clause for two reasons. First, these are obvious indications of alteration violating Gray v. Maryland, and they do not require the same kind of contextual inference that was required in Richardson v. Marsh. Second, these redactions create inevitable associations with particular defendants under this circuit's precedent of Serial v. United States and Washington v. United States. With regard to the first one.
Do you need the Serial standard to win? Do you need us to apply inevitable association to win?
Your Honor, we don't believe so. We think that we can win both under Gray and under the inevitable association. We think that under Gray, these alterations were clear on the face of the statements for several reasons. First, we think that the volume of the redactions, more than 70 in total for all defendants, the seven statements that are under consideration here, took up almost 6 days of trial. And they're grammatically incorrect examples of alterations. For instance, Demereux is referred to in Mr. Clark's statement as second guy or other guy, not the other guy. For instance, the Jazz case out of the Second Circuit comments on use of, hey, other guy. And the statement goes on.
But didn't the Supreme Court itself cite a statement, say it would have made things okay in the Gray case had the statement been changed from, you know, I, delete, delete, and some other guys did something to I and some other guys did something?
Your Honor, the Gray court did say that.
And so that's what the government did here.
Well, we don't think so. We think that that's distinguishable for several reasons. First, the me, deleted, deleted, and a few other guys removes the reference to the individuals that are saying that there's a confrontation clause, the deleted individuals. So it's just me and a few other guys. So the statement would have been completely redacted, number one. Number two, it's a plural pronoun. The me and a few other guys is indeterminate on who it refers to. In this case, there were numerous one-to-one redactions. For instance, Demereux is redacted from Clark's statement, and Clark is redacted from Demereux's statement multiple times as the other guy or the other fellow.
Isn't it the case, though, Mr. Treister, that because this is a multi-defendant case and there are all the cooperators, there are many people involved in this hostage taking, that even when the references are to one other person, there are a lot of options as to who might be filling in those blanks. Even when you're talking about the two guys at the campsite, other people are coming and going, and it's just, I mean, I found it reading the record, it wasn't always clear.
Yeah, we don't think so, because we think that there's several reasons that the jury could have immediately made the connection to who is redacted. For instance, Kevon Demereux and Zion Clark both have statements that are introduced, and they track each other in numerous respects, but not in every respect. And so when the prosecution introduced Zion Clark's statement and then immediately introduced Mr. Demereux's statement, the jury would recognize that when they did similar things in both statements, that the other guy or the other fella redacted out of the statement, in fact, referred to Mr. Zion Clark or Mr. Kevon Demereux.
Help me out a little bit on why that isn't analogous to Richardson, where, I mean, there's a lot of evidence, other evidence in this case, that places the two of them as the guards of the campsite. And so the fact that then when you put these redacted statements in a context of all that other evidence, you start to say, well, I can guess who these two people are. Isn't that really well supported by the other evidence that places the two of them there together?
Your Honor, we don't think so. We think the way that it was done in this case is fundamentally different than what happened in Richardson. In fact, what we support is exactly what happened in Richardson, where the statement was fully redacted to remove the existence of the other individual. We think that in this case, where you have these specified roles, such as the gunmen or the guards, that it's clear on the face of the statement who the redaction is referring to. And so what we would want the confrontation clause, what we think it requires, is for redaction.
Although Judge Bates took a lot of care with ground rules for redactions and didn't allow references to a gunman or a guard, but just other people. And you get a huge windfall in a case like this if you apply a Richardson versus Marsh kind of analysis where it fictionally acts like people are acting alone and talking to themselves when, you know, it just makes a hash of what actually happened. So you need some placeholders for human beings in some situations, don't you?
Your Honor, we don't necessarily think so. We think that it would require further redaction, for instance, when Mr. Clark says that he's talking to somebody else, and that somebody else is Mr. Dimmeroo, perhaps that would not be able to come in because it couldn't be properly redacted. But we think the Supreme Court's precedent, Bruton and then Richardson and then v. Gray, we think that speaks to this issue of full redaction and whether or not, you know, when the prosecution both wants joint trials and they want to introduce these statements that incriminate other individuals, it requires something more.
Well, I see that as perhaps a permissible reading of the Supreme Court cases, but we're bound by our decision in Washington, which seems to go much further, and that it's okay to use an individual or others at the scene. And yes, it tends to incriminate the defendant, but as long as it doesn't expressly implicate the particular defendant, that's permissible under our precedent.
Your Honor, that's correct. That is what this circuit held in Washington. But Gray postdates Washington, and we're arguing that we think these are both obvious indications of alteration under Gray and inevitable associations. And we think that the redactions in Gray are fundamentally different.
Gray doesn't postdate Washington. Postdates Serio, but not Washington.
Gray v. Maryland's 1998, and Washington's 1991.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. 1992, yeah.
And so we think that the redactions in this case, where it's obvious on the face and it doesn't take the jury very long to realize that these statements have been altered, and they start to wonder, well, what was removed? Who was removed? Who was acting here? Who was acting there? We think that that's what Gray warns against, and we think that that's why we should win under Gray, but we also think we should win under Serio because we think Washington, where this practice was allowed in a very finite amount of redactions, we think those redactions were different for several reasons. First,
can I take you back on this? What do you do with the Ralph Wilson case, which really does seem to allow these types of statements and say we're not going to require full redaction and inference is okay?
Well, my reading of the Ralph Wilson case, number one, the statement was hardly incriminating at all. And number two, it wasn't redacted at all. And neutral pronouns were not used. This court made a reference.
The relevance of the Wilson case is not factual identity, but it's recognition that, look, if the end result is that this is part of the jigsaw puzzle that the jury puts together, that's okay. That's not a confrontation clause problem. We'll assume the jury follows its instructions.
We think that Wilson, perhaps, Your Honor, we have a disagreement that we think that Ralph Wilson stands for the proposition that where the statement is not incriminating on its face to the defendant, and where that statement is not redacted, that it can come in under the Supreme Court's precedent, under this circuit's precedent. But if I could just quickly get back to the Washington question, because I think that that's an important point.
Can I just clarify one thing? Your position is that these are incriminating on their face.
Yes, Your Honor.
Had they been introduced at the beginning of trial with no other evidence yet in the case, the jury would have known which person each one referred to?
We think so. We think it's like Gray. The me deleted and a few other guys. It was clear on the face that it had been redacted. And the problem is when the jury starts to wonder what has been redacted. And we think given the volume of redactions, and U.S. v. Wilson out of the Eighth Circuit speaks to this concern with volume of redactions. That case had 40 redactions. This case has upwards of 70. We think that it's clear on the face that there were, in fact, redactions, and the jury starts to wonder. And so,
but was it clear here that there were, in fact, redactions? I mean, there are all kinds of references to I went up, and we went in to get the man, and then there was the other guy, and we did this, and I met the other guy. And I mean, there were a couple places that you point to in months of trial where the guy references were a little bit ungrammatical. But on the whole, I mean, you all had opportunities to look at them before, and the jury didn't take these statements. That these were put in through the FBI officer's testimony, no?
That's absolutely true. But we think all it takes is one, maybe two instances of where the jury can immediately tell that they've been redacted. And we cite two, and also there's Nurse's testimony where he is relating a statement. I see that I'm over my time. Please finish.
You can finish answering the question.
Take Nurse's statement where he's relating Seeley's statement regarding Nixon, and he blurts out Nixon's name in open court, and there's an immediate warning to the jury.
And the government has conceded that that was a Bruton error.
Right, exactly. But we think that the jury, based on that, based on the grammatically incorrect alterations, based on the volume, based on the one-to-one comparison, based on the failure to redact actions, we think that that means that they're quit on their faith. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, David Goodhand for the United States. Once again, Judge Bates, in a very thoughtful, careful fashion, ensured that these confessions did not violate Gray, did not violate Bruton, and in also ineluctably ensured that the jury would be able to follow its instructions. These were not facially incriminatory. All of the identifiers were excised. The proper names were excised. And this was a case involving the jury heard 13 different people participated in the Maharaj kidnapping itself. Seven of them, of course, were sitting at the counsel's table. Four of the cooperators took the stand, participated in that. So to the extent that there's a suggestion that simply because a jury heard another guy that they would be able to link that up is difficult.
Well, but there are some of these that seemed less than neutral. So, for example, you know, the other guard, when, yeah, there's a lot of folks, but the entire thrust of the case is that were, you know, there were the two abductors, there were the two guards, there were the instigators. And so when one person is saying the other guard, is that really a neutral pronoun? Is that really neutral, or is that pretty much pointing the arrow right at the other person?
It's not pointing the arrow right at either Clark or Demereaux. And just as an example, the jury heard, for example, that there was another guard who participated in one of the 404B incidents with Clark. His name was Nigel Ferret. If the jury had wanted to, or if they were worried, they could have thought about that. In addition, even with respect to the Maharaj kidnapping, Joseph points out that initially, after they abducted Mr. Maharaj, they dropped Mr. Maharaj off in a cocoa field, and some guy named Tiba took possession of Mr. Maharaj. They later then picked up Mr. Maharaj from Tiba. But my point being that even if you consider that, and that was a slip-up, which, you know, we've noted in our brief that it did not adhere to Judge Bates's general guidelines about taking out all descriptors. That was a slip-up. It wasn't caught by the government. It wasn't caught by the other parties. In that respect, you know, we would suggest they actually in plain error context with respect to that. But even putting that aside, I think the volume of defendants coupled with the other people who even participated as guards via the description and the evidence were okay.
Well, what about the Clark statement comes in, and then right after that we ask, so you went and re-interviewed Mr. Demereaux after that. And that seemed to me to fit pretty closely the pattern in Gray. Statement comes in, so then you went and arrested person B. Is your answer to that, you're right, that one doesn't qualify as neutral given that back-to-back pattern, but it's harmless error, or are you actually arguing that it's fine to have the statement come in and then say, so, then after this you went and interviewed co-defendant?
I'm not arguing harmless. I don't think that made the inevitable association / facially incriminatory suggestion that the defendants have posited. Number one, the confession came in, there was a lengthy bench conference, and then there was a question about, well, did you go back and re-interview Demereaux afterwards? Didn't say arrest, in contrast to Gray, number one.
Does that matter for the linkage point? Who the other guy is?
I think it absolutely matters for this reason. if your jury is in the jury room trying to think, okay, this other guy, he was involved, why wouldn't the police officer, though, arrest that guy, number one? Number two, I think it's telling that when that unfolded, that sequence, even defense counsel didn't pick up on that. They didn't point out to the judge, my gosh, look what just happened here. And, you know, in fact, in Gray, in Judge Scalia's dissent, he points out that that absence of an objection, a granted dissent in the Gray case, but that absence of objection means that, you know, we're either in a waiver or a plain error context.
Do you have any other cases that you can point to where there's such a large number of redactions? This really does seem different from other Bruton precedents.
There are a significant number of redactions. That, I would suggest, is a function of the loquaciousness, if you will, of some of these defendants. In particular, we have Clark, who confessed over the course of a number of days, four different times. Mr. Seeley confessed twice. Mr. Demereau.
Right, and you got lucky with a lot of people who were speaking to you. But what's the precedent that's closest in a court of appeals with anything like this number, even if it's not our court?
I'm not sure I can say whether Priester involved this many redactions or not. Priester, of course, is helpful to the government because of the sheer number of defendants. But this is when you have seven co-defendants on trial, and of those seven co-defendants, five of them confess, and you have multiple confessions over the course of those, I think that puts this in sort of a sui generis category. And
but the defendants are saying, you know, cut out big chunks of those where you can't really do a non-facially incriminating redaction. Just, you know, don't use a lot of the conversations that would be really hard to redact.
That actually was part of Judge Bates's general guidelines, and that was done in many instances. But what the case law provides for, and JAS in particular I would point to from the Second Circuit, says the government is not required, A, to either excise some of its good evidence relating to, for example, a conspiracy, number one. Number two, the government is not required to also distort the statement. So my point is, in adherence to Judge Bates' guidelines, we did excise a lot of material that that otherwise wouldn't have informed our conspiracy charge. When we didn't, we adhered to his rules. The bottom line here is what Bruton says is it's a narrow exception. We generally assume in almost all categories of cases that juries follow their instructions. It's only when you get into a category of facially incriminatory direct inference of vividness about the pointing, a blank space, a word redacted.
So what about I'm just following up on Judge Millett's questions about sort of the pairs of abductor, the pair of guards. If we were to find that there was a, you know, direct implication there, would you just give us your best harmless error case on that?
Well, sure. To the extent that we're, for example, if we're talking about Clark, Clark is a man who led the law enforcement officers to the body. He literally knew where this body was buried. Not only did he know where the body was buried, he could identify whether the head that had been decapitated was in the blue barrel or in the cooler. He also was identified by several cooperators as participating. Joseph had very vivid testimony. When he went up there on a regular basis to get proof of life, who was there? It was Clark. And he was, in fact, assisting when Joseph was trying to get the proof of life. In addition, when we're in the harmless error category, you can't discount the fact that Clark himself put himself there. I confessed. I was the one who was there. So in that respect, I think we have a very powerful harmless error argument, both with respect to Clark, Demereau, and Seeley.
Do you have a view on whether the Serio inevitable association test is still or should still be the law of the circuit?
I don't think it is or should be. I think Wilson recognized that Gray unfolded after Serio, obviously. Wilson says inferential incrimination pursuant to Gray is outside the boundaries of Bruton, number one. Number two, just the phrase, I think Washington pre-Gray defined inevitable association as a chain of inferences ineluctably leading to an association. Well, if we're in the context of talking about a chain of inferences, we're already in a context where Gray says you're okay. That is, Gray says only direct, immediate inferences. So, I'm sorry. I think Serio does not survive Gray, and I think Wilson recognizes that.
Do you think we need to decide that in this case, or do you think you can win under Serio?
We can win under Serio, even if you go through a chain of inferences. Because of the number of participants, the number of people who went up to that camp, you do not have that ineluctable association on the back end of a chain of inferences.
Okay. Thank you. Did Mr. Treister have any time left? You can take 1 minute if you'd like it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yeah. I'll be very quick. First of all, I want to address the question of whether Gray overruled Serio. And we just want to point to numerous other circuits, including the First, the Third, the Seventh, a case that we didn't cite in our brief but came up recently from the Fifth Circuit, which is U.S. v. Nagari, 449, Federal Appendix 259, and the Eleventh Circuit. All of these circuits would consider other evidence in some fashion in considering whether the Confrontation Clause is violated. I also want to address Priester v. Holmes. Priester v. Holmes is distinguishable because there are numerous individuals at the same place at the same time doing the same thing. That's not this case. And finally, Jass is an important point with regard to the Count 1 evidence because the prosecution said that they needed the statements for Count 1 evidence. But in this case, unlike in Jass, where there were only two people, the prosecution could have gotten that critical Count 1 evidence from any number of other individuals, including the cooperators themselves. Thank you, Your Honor. Okay,
thank you.
Continuing with case number 11-3054 et al., United States v. Stryker, Brady Napu of the evidence, Mr. Zucker for the appellant, Mr. Goodhand for the appellees.
Good morning. I request 3 minutes for rebuttal. The instant case is the most recent case to show why it behooves the prosecution and favors them to essentially ignore or at least not comply with this court's and other courts' frequent admonitions that Brady be disclosed timely in advance of trial when the defense can make effective use of it in integrating and planning for a defense strategy. In this case, there's three elements to any Brady issue. Two of them are uncontested, that the material was favorable, that it was suppressed, and the only element at issue is going to be whether or not it was prejudiced. And the prosecution uses their frequent refrain that it was disclosed in time for the defense to make some use of it, and whatever use made by the defense is therefore effective use, so there is no prejudice.
Can I just ask a factual question? And that is, I assume there were other Brady disclosures early on in the case. And do we know, one, is my assumption correct? And two, do we know that at the time other Brady disclosures were made, they had this information but held it back and didn't include it with the other Brady information they were disclosing?
Addressing both parts, the first part, I don't know the answer. I do not recall off the top of my head any other Brady disclosures being made, but I cannot say they specifically weren't for other defendants. As to whether or not they knew this information, they knew it in 2006, in February of 2006, in January of 2006, when the FBI was in Trinidad and participated in the investigation. This Brady, and by this Brady, I'm obviously referring to, the principal one I'm referring to is the issue of Russell Joseph's first statement to Trinidadian police on January 17th, 2006. He's the first cooperator who comes in. He comes in and says, I know I'm going to be arrested, and I'm worried Jason Percival is going to kill me because he's worried that I'll cooperate against him. He gives a version of events in which he inculpates Ricardo Stevenson and T, and does not mention Ricardo DeFore nor Seeley. Subsequently, approximately a week later, Jason Percival comes in. The Trinidadian government agrees to make him a witness and not prosecute him, and he gives a different version where he inculpates DeFore and Seeley, and as a result of subsequently, Joseph is changing his testimony to be consistent with Percival's, who it's clear the government has made their lead person in this case and bought into his theory because they're not even prosecuting him. They're using him exclusively as a witness. And so if Joseph is going to get any benefit from this, it is incumbent upon him to adopt whatever it is that Percival has told the police. That was Brady when it was made, or at least Brady when it became clear that the government was pursuing another theory. It was the theory that the FBI adopted, and they were aware of it in 2006. As the court is aware, it was not disclosed. It was not even the usual instance in where these things come up is in a Jenks disclosure. This trial had started, and in the initial Jenks package for Mr. Joseph, when he was called as a witness, two statements were omitted. The first was, we learned of and made a request for it. It was the February 20th, 2006 statement, and I may be off by a day or two on the days, but it was the first statement made by Joseph where the FBI took that statement. That was not disclosed initially as Jenks. We requested that. When we got that statement, it made reference to a January 17th, 2006 statement given to the Trinidadian authorities by Russell Joseph, and the prosecution had not disclosed that in either instance. When we requested it, they disclosed that day. It was the day that Mr. Joseph was on the stand, and the defense had minimal opportunity to integrate that into the defense strategy. Now,
when did the Jenks Act disclosure occur? Where in the trial process? Was it right before Joseph took the stand on direct?
I believe the judge's ruling was that it was supposed to be 2 days prior to the witnesses testifying, and this was slightly late. Mm-hmm. But the disclosure of the relevant, of the critical piece of Jenks, the January 17th, 2006, was, I believe, literally the morning Russell Joseph was about to be cross-examined. I know he was already on the stand. I'm positive he was on the stand because I remember getting it.
And so is your position that this statement about Steve-O should have been in the Jenks disclosure or earlier than the Jenks
much
disclosure?
Earlier. Much earlier. It was clearly Brady. I mean, what could be more critically Brady than an accusation that two other people have committed the offense the government has charged? I mean, is there anything else that could be more blatantly Brady and should have been disclosed?
And what's your response then to their argument that...
No prejudice.
You got time. And two aspects to that. What is your response in the record?
Okay.
And is it right that I have to review the district court's determination that it wasn't prejudicial under a clear error standard of review? What do you do with Paxson? So Paxson tells me clear error, and then tell me your argument about why there was prejudice.
Okay. The prejudice is there was use made of it, in the sense that it was used as effectively as you can use an inconsistent statement. And I will concede we got some mileage out of that. The prejudice was it did not alert us to the third-party perpetrator defense that screened out from that disclosure. And I never integrated that into the defense theory. Had this been disclosed pretrial, we would have been alerted that there was a third-party perpetrator defense that could have been asserted. And there was ample evidence to support that, which frankly had been disclosed, but we didn't appreciate the value of because it was the Gopal evidence. The Gopal evidence, in Gopal, Stevenson performed all the roles that were attributed to Defoe in this case. He was a soldier, he drove the clear car, he transported the guns, he provided the licenses. He even in this case, he was the one that instigated it by bringing Nurse to Percival, and that started the whole Maharaj thing going.
Okay. How do I get around Paxson? Paxson said clear error review of this.
I believe Anderson and Kyle's piece, Whitley, and the majority of the case will say that a Brady violation is reviewed de novo as an error of law.
Well, the particular question of whether you could make effective use of it.
The effective use was we were precluded. I'd say, frankly, the most analogous case to this case is the more recent decision from the D.C. Court of Appeals by Judge Schwelp in U.S. versus Miller, where the defense had the issue in that case was the government did not disclose in the grand jury one of the witnesses indicated that the shooter was left-handed, the defendant was right-handed. There was a possible third-party perpetrator who was actually a government witness. The defense was able to use the right hand, left hand in examining the witnesses. But what they failed to do and realized post-trial was that a videotape of the person who accused the defendant and who was a potential third-party perpetrator and was on the scene And the videotape showed when he signs his statement or his rights card, he was left-handed. So they were not able to integrate that.
You're way over time, but go ahead and finish this.
Okay. They were not able to integrate that into the preparation and presentation of defense. They were precluded from introducing and developing a third-party perpetrator defense.
Okay.
In this case, we have the exact same scenario here, where had the government disclosed in advance and complied with their Brady obligations, we would have recognized the potential value of the Gopal evidence, which was completely ignored because it was not coming in. It was a 404B that the court had ruled inadmissible prior to Defoe even being extradited to the United States.
Okay.
So no time was spent on that.
All right. Thank you very much. Let's hear from the government.
Thank you, please, Court. David Goodhand again for the United States. Before I answer any questions the court has, I want to make sure that I draw the court's attention to something. In a couple instances when my opponent was standing here, he said they did not recognize the significance of the Gopal 404B incident until after trial. And he makes a great deal of hay out of the fact that if I had made that recognition before, when the Joseph statement had been given to me, if it had been properly timed out, I would have made that recognition. I just want to very quickly point the court's attention to the joint appendix at 3239, and this is dated June 3rd, 2009. And when they are talking about the late disclosure of the Joseph statement, DeFore's counsel actually makes the precise connection that my opponent is now suggesting he didn't realize and didn't make until after trial. He talks about Stevenson is accused of being a driver of the lead car, references Gopal, talks about were I aware that this initial statement Mr. Joseph had said Stevenson was also the driver in this kidnapping, blah, blah, blah. My point is that that recognition was made as of June 3rd, 2009. If I can turn briefly to the issue of standard review, I want to clarify two things. Number one, my opponent suggested that we've conceded two of the three elements relating to Brady. We have not conceded suppression. And I think this funnels back to the issue of clear error versus de novo. I think Paxson stands for the proposition that when you're assessing suppression as opposed to materiality, you are in a clear error context, which makes sense. You have the judge on the ground making an assessment of whether or not this was material that was timely provided such that the defendant had an opportunity to use it. That's different from what Awuji says relating to prong three, reasonable probability if they didn't get it at any time at all, and we're now trying to assess whether or not there's a reasonable probability of a different outcome. So did not concede the second prong. We think suppression didn't happen here. It was just tardy, conceitedly.
Were there prior Brady disclosures and this was left out?
Yes, Your Honor. The trial counsel has informed me that did turn over Brady evidence long before trial as part of the regular discovery. There's no doubt this was not included in it. It was an oversight. It was inadvertent. I think the district court found as much. But the Joseph statement, I want to clarify something else. This was given to the defendant on May 29th. I'm almost positive that was before Joseph even took a stand on direct. They then used it very, very robustly in cross-examination. 2 months then thereafter unfolded. If they had wanted to move the court to reconsider the preclusion of the Gopal 404B evidence, they could have done it in that 2 months. They didn't. They sat on their hands. And at the end of the day, I think that's why Judge Bates in the post-trial decision said, as a matter of fact, they got this in enough time to effectively use it. Alternatively, he said, look, this is not material. And I think that's also a very powerful alternative ground when you consider that DeFore also confessed and that at least three of the four cooperators specifically identified DeFore as a very active participant in this kidnapping and conspiracy.
Any questions?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Did counsel used up all his time, right? Would you like to take an extra minute? Okay.
The disclosure was made I just checked with my associate, was actually made the day Joseph was on the stand. The appreciating the relevance of it was made well after Joseph was gone and was certainly after the defense had Had it been disclosed timely, the defense would have had an opportunity to incorporate that, to think about it, and to work it into a defense. Coming in, I believe the disclosure, what they're referring to, was made in the Jenks disclosure of Percival, which was in June of 2009, and contained information about the Gopal. But the focus was certainly not on that, because the Gopal kidnapping, again, had been excluded by the court. And what it goes back to, I think, you know...
What would be your answer to the... Look, DeFore confessed. So this wasn't going to be material anyhow.
That goes back to the government's claim that, you know, anytime there's an error like this, that A, the error is harmless, and B, there was overwhelming evidence. The evidence in this case was far, I would suggest, far from overwhelming. There were four cooperators, two of whom inculpated Defoe, and both of whom were inconsistent with each other. Defoe took the stand and testified as to why he gave a false confession, what he was promised by the Trinidadian authorities. So, and in assessing Defoe's confession, I think another interesting thing, Defoe's claim was that he basically signed off on what they told him, and what they told him was based on Percival's information. And what was interesting in it is that there is a change between Percival's first statement as to how he got to the scene, claims he was with Defoe, and that they drove together, and then Defoe has that in his statement as well. Percival subsequently changes his version of events and says, no, I didn't go there with Defoe, I went there on my own. So it's interesting that if this was a true confession, why does it contain the one mistake that Trinidadian authorities would have been aware of from Percival's version that Percival later changed?
Okay.
Additionally, in assessing that confession...
One more sentence. That's it. Go ahead, finish it.
I'm trying to remember my train of thought. In assessing that confession, I think we have to look at the inconsistencies between what came out at trial regarding that confession, i.e. what the Trinidadian authorities knew, and what the master, I forget his name, the title of the judicial officer who signed off on it, and then what was shown as a trial, because they were very different, and they would throw into question just how much weight that confession should be given. Thanks for the extra couple of sentences.
Okay. Miranda, right?
Right.
Okay.
So, issue 5 relating to Miranda versus Arizona. Mr. Rosenzweig for the appellants, Mr. Goodhand for the appellees.
Rosenzweig, 10 feet. That's the distance between Judge Tatel and Judge Pillard. It's also the distance between where Special Agent Freeman of the FBI sat and where the un-Mirandized confession of Christopher Seeley was taken. Yet the government would have you think that this was not a joint venture investigation. To negate that conclusion, they rely on an inaccurate statement of the law and disregard the facts of the investigation relating to this matter. The inaccurate statement of law is the suggestion that in order to find a joint venture, the defendants must demonstrate that there was both coordination and direction or control of the foreign police force by the FBI. That's simply wrong as a matter of law and as a matter of policy. As a matter of law, it stems from dicta that was unnecessary to the decision of Abu Ali and is inconsistent with the seminal case on joint venture, the Emery case, where a DEA joint investigation with the Mexican police resulted in the interrogation of a Mexican drug lord.
Whose custody were they in when they were in Trinidad?
The Trinidadians, ma'am.
What case holds that Miranda requires custodial interrogation? What case holds that the custody and the interrogator can be different people?
Your Honor, that would be, there have been several cases in which the custody of the interrogatee has been in the foreign police force, in which the question has been whether or not the joint venture doctrine applies. I would cite the Bin Laden case. I would cite the Abu Ali case.
Do those hold, or do they just assume Miranda applies and then go on and address joint venture?
Well, that is the holding, I believe, Your Honor, of the Youssef case and the Enri terrorist bombing cases from the Second Circuit.
I think they just assume.
In most of the others, I think you're correct that they assume the application of Miranda as a general matter from the fact of custody and the joint venture, and then move quickly to the joint venture doctrine.
Let me bring you just to the specific facts of this case. We have a very specific set of district court findings on this question. He says that the testimony overwhelmingly establishes is there were two distinct interviews. The first with the Trinidad police, but excluded Freeman, and the second with Freeman, and then he says, quote, they were not acting in coordination at the time of this interview. FBI didn't participate in the arrest, nor was it even remotely involved in scheduling the interview. And then he says Freeman wasn't allowed to participate in the interview, only permitted to conduct a second interview. So, I mean, he ultimately concludes with these factual findings that whatever information sharing might have occurred as to other defendants, there's nothing to support a joint venture that they were acting jointly on this day. And you don't challenge any of those findings.
We don't challenge the findings themselves, Your Honor.
So for you to prevail, don't you then have to show that the district court should not have looked just at what was going on that date?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay. So why don't you make your case on that?
Yes. We think that the entire that decision by Judge Bates is inconsistent with, for example, Emory, where, in fact, a joint venture was found, even though there as well the DE agents were not present at the actual interrogation that was conducted of the Mexican national who'd been arrested. We think that the right test is whether or not over the course of the 18 months of this investigation there was sufficient coordination, control, and integration to render it a joint venture.
And what's evidence the best of that, case that supports that?
Evidence of that would
what's the best case that supports that? In other words, if we were going to agree with you that the district court's focus was too narrow, what case would we cite for that?
The best case would be the Emory case, Your Honor, which is though it does not say so in hac verba, it is explicitly that conclusion, that the extension of the investigation prior to the interrogation is what makes the independent interrogation not excluded from the joint venture. Here we have a course of conduct in which the United States provided the forensic assistance at the campsite, in which it participated in the interviews of a half dozen of the other defendants throughout in Mr. Straker, Mr. Gittins, one of the cooperating witnesses, Mr. Demeriou in his first set of interviews in January. That is, in our judgment, best described as a situation in which the Trinidadian police brought their own local knowledge, understanding of the people, access to informants, and the United States government provided technical expertise, some of its instruments, and that makes this, over the course of those 18 months, a joint venture.
Judge Bates held that the warnings that were given under Trinidadian law were the functional equivalent of Miranda warnings. That's not something that the defendants have appealed, is it?
That's correct, Your Honor. Our argument below and our argument here is that that essentially sounds in a voluntariness argument. But if there is a joint venture, then the functional equivalent doctrine doesn't apply. If there's a joint venture, we must have had the Miranda warnings in the first instance.
Okay.
If this were solely a voluntariness case, that would be the judge.
I don't follow that. I mean, if there's a functional equivalent of Miranda, then the people have been Mirandized? Or you're saying, no, the functional equivalence only speaks to voluntariness or not?
My interpretation of what Judge Bates said, Your Honor, is that he spoke to whether or not the first confession by Mr. Seeley to the Trinidadian police was in fact voluntary and would have met the voluntariness standard, and it was voluntary because the warnings, in his judgment, were functionally equivalent.
I read it as that they were effectively Mirandized.
Well, I would suggest that they are not. They certainly lack some of the components of this. There was no affirmative admonition of your right to remain silent. There was the admonition that what you say can and will be used against you. So,
I thought it did have, I may be misremembering, but I thought it did have the right to remain silent and that what you say can and will be used against you, and you have a right to counsel, but you don't have a right, if you can't afford counsel, to have the government appoint counsel for you. But I don't understand that was ever challenged.
I may be misremembering it as well, Your Honor, and I would certainly defer to whatever the record was.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, David.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Your Honor.
What about Emory?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I apologize. I'm not familiar with the facts, Emory. I'm going to be candid here. I can't stand up to distinguish that for you. I apologize.
That's all right.
I think even if we were to assess the scope of the investigation, if we were back up from just the interview here, that is Seeley, the sequential Freeman afterwards, and look back at the investigation, what we have here are testimony from the officers that these were parallel investigations, homicide, kidnapping. One did not tell what the other to do, and there are several instances of the testimony where Agent Klaus, for example, hears for the first time when he gets to Trinidad on January 2nd, oh, we're going to arrest Clark and Demereaux. There are also very many occasions in the testimony where you hear Klaus and or Cruz and or Freeman had to ask permission to see one of the defendants, and then Lucas, the lead investigator in Trinidad, would provide that permission. And so I think if we're talking about coordination and direction, what we have here is cooperation, of course, and I think the agents were quite candid about that. We did cooperate, but we don't have the kind of control where we have to worry about federal FBI agents doing an end run around Miranda. I would suggest if that was their attitude, they were doing a really poor job of it, because the alternative ruling that Judge Bates found with respect to the Trinidadian warnings, there's a lot there that has the look and feel of Miranda. What I understand Judge Bates to have done, and this is, at JA 577, note 24, what happened was the Justice of the Peace gave you have the right to remain silent. If you do not remain silent, it can be used against you. And then there was the additional, consistent with Trinidadian law, you have the right to have either a legal representative, a friend, or a relative present. And in fact, I think Mr. Seeley had his father present during that confession.
Does it matter what they said to him about his rights vis-a-vis the Trinidad system of justice? Doesn't the FBI have to do its own to assure somebody what their rights are vis-a-vis the United States and the FBI? And so why does it matter what the Trinidadian warnings were?
Well, I think In re terrorist bombings, I think, is the best sort of explication of what functional equivalency is in this context. And they talk about, we have to look at whether or not, the FBI agents gave the defendant the proper information relating to what Trinidadian law would provide. So they did that. Mm-hmm. Agent Freeman did an international advice of rights when he came in.
Right.
But I guess my point is if we're worried about whether or not the Trinidadian warnings suffice, they told him, consistent with Trinidad law, he could get to an attorney if he wanted to. And so if we're thinking about what the core values of Miranda are, trustworthiness.
But the they that told them about Trinidad was the FBI agents or the Trinidadian officials?
The latter.
Right. And I guess my point is a different one, and that is, Trinidad folks are in there questioning you. They leave. FBI comes in. It doesn't really matter what happened. Now you need to assure this person what their relationship is with the FBI and the U.S. government. And so, yes, they had the international rights form, but I'm not sure why we would transport whatever their assurances were vis-a-vis the Trinidadian government to their assurances vis-a-vis the FBI.
I apologize. I misunderstood. Mm-hmm. I guess all I'm suggesting is that stop the equation before Agent Freeman enters the room, and you can look at what the Trinidadian authorities provided to the defendants and say that's the functional equivalent of Miranda. We don't have to worry about unduly coercive nature of the questioning such that this man does not understand, he doesn't have to talk if he doesn't want to.
And who is it? Help me understand who the custodian was, why we even have a Miranda custodial situation here. He wasn't going to look at the FBI and say, wow, you have the power to make my life better or worse in sort of the original Miranda sense. I'm stuck here because of the Trinidadians. So do we even have a custody in the Miranda sense?
Well, Miranda only applies if foreign officials are acting in concert with U.S. authorities.
I'm asking a separate question, and maybe yours is different. If you don't have a joint venture, would you still be in custody of the U.S. for purposes of Miranda, even if there's not a joint venture, when you're being questioned by the FBI in a place where you're not free to leave?
If you don't have a joint venture, then we don't care what the Trinidadian authorities do,
exactly,
consistent to their own law.
Right.
We don't care
only about what the FBI agents did.
Exactly.
Right.
And unless they're acting in cahoots with the Trinidadian authorities, that's when we start to care. But other than that, Miranda's just not on the table. We can't inform the decision-making or the conduct of the Trinidadian authorities. So if that answers your question, we don't care about custody or not with respect to Trinidadian authorities if you conclude that they were not acting in joint venture with the FBI.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, thank you. Any time left? Okay, you can take 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will make three very brief points. The first is that, again, Mr. Goodhand repeated the requirement that there be direction and control. If that is the law, the joint venture doctrine is a dead letter, since no sovereign police force will ever subject itself to the direction of the FBI. The second point, with respect to the question you've been asking, Judge Millett, about the application of Miranda overseas, is that the doctrine seems to have developed that the custodial, the identity of the custodian does not matter. Perhaps it should, but at least as far as I read the law, with respect to what the Second Circuit has said, what the Ninth Circuit has said, it does not. And then the last point that I would make is simply a factual one as to whether or not this was coordination and cooperation of the sort that creates a joint venture. I would submit that you can read the entire record of this matter and not find a single instance in which the Trinidadian police force rejected a request from the FBI for a cooperative instance.
Do we need to look for joint venture? Does that need to encompass the entire investigation, or could you have some independence in investigations but joint venture in just questioning, for example?
I would think it would be either, Your Honor. My
assessment
is... Your
position is which one happened here?
I would say that this was clearly not a joint venture in the questioning, except to the extent that by immediately following one after the other, you kind of get into the Siebert, you know, you can't possibly, it would be unusual not to repeat what you just said question. Our submission here is that it's the entire course of conduct.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We've made it to the last issue. Edwards.
Stephen Kirsch on behalf of Anderson Straker. I would like to reserve 1 minute. I'm going to discuss the issue, as Judge Taylor just said, related to Edwards versus Arizona. The factual chronology, well, the significant factual chronology, I don't believe is in dispute. In January of 2006, Anderson Straker was interviewed at a Trinidadian police station by at least three members of the FBI and one member of the Trinidad Police Force. He didn't make any inculpatory statements at that point. That statement, that interview, was then terminated by the FBI agent when Straker said, "I really don't want to speak anymore without my attorney." And so we don't contest that. 18 months later, in July of 2007, after Straker had been indicted and he's taken into custody by the FBI and being transported to the United States, that's when we submit the Edwards violation occurred. And the critical period of time, obviously, with respect to this case, is what happened in between the first interrogation in January of 2006 and the second interrogation in July of 2007. And the issue relates to waiver. And just briefly, I just want to discuss some Supreme Court language relating to the very difficult burden that the government has in proving that there's a waiver.
This is how do we know Edwards even applies to questioning overseas by someone in custody of a foreign government? It's been described as a double prophylaxis, Miranda squared or something. And so why does that prophylaxis on police conduct itself apply overseas?
Well, the government hasn't raised that issue. I understand the court is raising it. The government hasn't raised it. The government's never said that Edwards does not apply, and Judge Bates never said, let's discuss the issue of whether Edwards apply. We just all presumed, and I believe it does apply, because in the January statement, there were members of the FBI. There were three members of the FBI. The record is disputed as to whether or not they were armed and whether or not Mr. Straker was handcuffed. But clearly, there was a custodial interrogation. And then in July of 2007, which produced the inculpatory statement, that was, Mr. Straker was in physical custody of Agent Cruz of the FBI. So I
was. He was Mirandized then, coming into San Juan before he was questioned. He was Mirandized. So it's, the question isn't so much waiver as whether there's an Edwards bar.
It's an Edwards bar. Well, right. But the question is, was there? Judge Bates said there was a waiver.
Or initiation.
That he initiated, and therefore the waiver, the what would be invalid if the waiver bar applied, but valid if there were no bar, is determined by the invocation, no?
That's right. And the government's, well, just stepping back, but the government's conceded that that there was a Fifth Amendment invocation by Strager, no question, back in January of 2006.
And I'm asking, I guess, you concede that there was adequate Miranda rights read at the time of, in San Juan, and so the question is,
yes.
Did the Edwards bar apply or not?
That's right.
Okay.
And the Supreme Court, time in and time again, has said that we have to indulge every presumption against waiver. So they've made a very, very high bar for the government to satisfy in order to satisfy whether or not it's a waiver. And focusing in factually on this, what this waiver is, this all comes about because the government's position through this testimony of Agent Freeman that Strager called Freeman at some point after the initial interview and left a voice message, said to something effect that, I want to talk. But that voice message...
Wait, is that what he said? We don't have a copy. We don't have the message, right? That's not in the record.
The message...
Don't we just have the testimony that he asked to be called back?
Yes.
And did he say, I want to talk?
Well, that's... In the government's brief, that's what it says.
I was asking your view of the record.
I believe it was. He just said something to that effect.
Wait, are you sure of that?
I thought there were two different inconsistent two versions of what he said.
Are you sure? I thought the district court found that all he said was, call me back.
Well, if that's...
Am I misreading this or not? It's your record.
No, I understand. I believe that is what Judge Bates finally determined, and I believe that's the record in this case.
Well,
that's his order. But my position is that this presumption...
Well, don't you think it's significantly different as to whether he said, call me back, or I want to talk?
No.
And you don't?
I don't. Because this, and just the confusion we're having here, demonstrates that this was not a valid waiver. Because the recording itself, it was a voicemail, that was not introduced into the record. They didn't have it. The date of the recording, that's not introduced because they don't have it. The specific substance was not recorded. The agent had no notes regarding the substance of what was communicated in that conversation. The agent knew nothing about, couldn't provide any information that would suggest that this was an initiation about Strager wanting to have a generalized, which is a term that Judge Bates applied from Valasquez, wanted to have a generalized conversation about the facts of crime. There was nothing in this record to suggest that.
What reason would he have to call other than to initiate discussion? Because he wasn't being held by the FBI. He was being held by the Trinidadian authorities. And so if it's something relating to, can I have access to, can I see my family members or minister, or can I get better digs, I don't have a blanket, he wouldn't be calling the FBI. But this is, he had a conversation at the time of the initial interview, which he invoked. And he said, I might be willing to talk after I talk to my lawyer. And they said, if you want to, here's the card. And that's the guy he called.
But that, I respectfully would disagree about the significance of that, because this is purely speculation. And we're talking about waiving someone's Fifth Amendment privilege. And we can't be speculating when the government has that high of a burden in establishing that there was a valid waiver. We have no idea why Strager made the call, what he was talking about. He could have been asked about anything.
Well, what Judge Bates has as a factual matter in opinion is testimony by Klaus and testimony by Cruz and, saying at that initial discussion what Strager said was he didn't want to sign anything, he didn't want to talk about the details of the case until he had a chance to speak to his lawyer, or
yes,
he would prefer to talk to his attorney before any questions. And then this discussion of, if you do want to reach us, here's the card. And then he calls, this is Anderson Strager, can you contact me? And I guess my question is, what explanation could there be other than that this was the conversation that was presaged in the first interview?
There could have been any reason. He could have been asking him about, when am I going to be released? What about the conditions?
And under Bradshaw, that's enough.
Excuse me?
And isn't that, I mean, under the Supreme Court's decision, isn't Bradshaw, that's enough to say, you know, can you tell me what's going to happen to me in my case?
But the Supreme Court has also said that not every conversation that a defendant initiates constitutes what the Supreme Court says is necessary to initiate the waiver.
Well, surely I want to talk.
We just don't know what we're speculating, and we can make up any factual scenario we want, but we don't know. We don't know the answer to that question, and without that information, the presumption cannot be overcome because it cannot satisfy the stringent standards that the Supreme Court has set.
Okay. Anything else? No. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, David Goodhand, the United States. What Agent Freeman testified to, this is at JA 2291, he said, I do recall getting a message from Straker asking that I return his call. Klaus added on to that saying, you know, I was told by Freeman that Straker had reached out to him about 2 or 3 weeks after.
But the only actual evidence we have is what Freeman testified to, correct?
Yes, yes.
That's all. We know there was a message to please call me back.
Yes,
right?
And then that...
So
I'm sorry.
How does that fit Oregon versus Brown? How does that quote evince a willingness and desire for a generalized discussion about the investigation? That's Justice Rehnquist's words.
Yes. You have to put it in the context, just as Judge Bates did. And in particular, I would point to the FBI 302 that was documented the interview that the FBI had with them, Straker earlier. And at the end of that interview, they said this with respect to what he was communicating to them. After having access to his attorney, he would be willing to speak to agents. And that's at JA 543, citing the 302. Put that in context and the general tenor of the descriptions from Klaus, Cruz, and Freeman about that conversation earlier in January was, he was feeling us out. He wanted to know what we had. He wanted to talk to his counsel. Once he talked to his counsel, he'd be willing.
We don't know that. You're guessing based on context, correct? I mean, he could have been asking about other things.
Well,
he might have been calling to find out about extradition or something.
Well,
right?
I think this circles back around to Velasquez and that Judge Bates cited. It would be a very odd thing to leave a man who indicates he would be willing to speak to agents, your business card. He knows the FBI is looking into him. He actually calls that FBI agent and not conclude appropriately that this was a willingness to talk about the investigation.
Except the conduct shows otherwise. Y'all didn't accept the offer. You ignored him for 17 months, right? No one called him back.
That's true.
So y'all didn't think he wanted to talk either.
No. The record demonstrates that we were very cautious. I can't remember the exact title of the Trinidadian authority, but he told us, you know what? He now has counsel. Don't talk to him. So that's what the record demonstrates.
How did you understand that? If you thought that he had reinitiated communications, what's the significance of the Justice of the Peace telling you that he had counsel and therefore you shouldn't contact him? If you thought, well, he's reinitiated, that doesn't matter.
Why would we take that risk? That's my bottom line.
What's the risk, though, in your view?
The risk is some court disagreeing with the notion that because he has counsel down in Trinidad, that the FBI should be, you know, reaching out to him and grabbing him on what Judge Pate called a close call with respect to initiation. Judge Mates made a factual finding. He said, look, this is a close call, but I think this equaled initiation.
Would you agree that without the context that you emphasized, that the simple call me back is not enough?
I would agree.
You would? Okay.
Yes. I'm sorry.
No, I understand. So for you to prevail here, we have to look at the context. Did the district court? He didn't.
No.
He just said, Judge Bates, who said this was a close call, he just said this is like Bradshaw.
No.
No? Did I misread
I'm citing to JA 555.
Yeah, what did you say?
I'm sorry. JA 555, this is a district court talking. This context is important.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Good point.
So, okay. You know, and this is a factual finding.
Right.
This is something that's, you have to show that this was just not something you could read into the record.
Yeah, I want to ask a different question. If you have someone who maybe initiates and it's ignored and then 17 more months go by, doesn't the initiation lapse? Why do you then get to use that initiation 17 months later? I mean, he whatever he did, you all ignored it, and he's done. Now, the last time he wants to start talking to the FBI would be not in their custody.
Defendant Straker has never suggested that his willingness waned in that period of time. He could have developed that record below if he wanted to show it.
No, I guess, is there any case law about, you know, you initiate and it's ignored? Does it lapse? I'm sorry. Does isn't acted upon, that's the end of it, and now we're back in the world where he's invoked it and 17 months later.
Never seen a case of this length of time, no. And frankly, I would have thought defendant would have persisted with suggesting, you know what, that initiation doesn't count because my willingness, it waned. I might have changed my mind. That didn't happen below, hasn't been pressed on appeal. That's why we think we can rely on the factual finding of the initiation here.
Maybe the defendant didn't believe that he had to argue that his interest in speaking waned because he didn't believe he'd ever express an interest in speaking that would be operative in the initiation sense. So it's a little bit counterintuitive to think here was someone who was eager to talk to the authorities. He called, he left a message, and then he didn't do anything else for 18 more months.
I don't think it's counterintuitive at all. He didn't get a return phone call from Freeman. Freeman was acting in a cautious fashion. He didn't return the call. Straker says, okay, that was a dead letter. It's not going anywhere. I'm not going to do anything else about it.
Okay.
Can I just ask one other question? Has the United States ever taken a position in litigation that Edwards applies in this setting overseas? You know,
I don't know the answer to that. I guess I'd be hard-pressed to understand why we would take a position that Edwards doesn't apply to the extent that Edwards emanates from Miranda. The case law seems to accept the proposition that if you're talking about federal agents overseas interrogating somebody, we want Miranda to be the overarching foundation. Edwards talks about, well, if you invoke your right to counsel, then all bets are off. You got to shut down. I can't see.
Right, but excuse me. But in your brief, here, footnote 93, you say below the government conceded applicability of the Fifth Amendment.
I think that's
to the
accurate.
FBI overseas, actually.
I think that's accurate.
Yeah, you actually conceded it. It's not a question of.
We appropriately conceded because I don't see the logical distinction to be drawn
it's
here.
It's just not before us, right? You conceded the issue in the district court.
Yes.
Right.
I wonder why you conceded the non-applicability of Schatzer. I don't understand why you would think that this is someone who's in the continuous Miranda custody of the United States when, in fact, up until he's extradited to Puerto Rico, he's in the custody of the Trinidadian authorities. And these FBI officials have no ability to affect the conditions of his detention and indictment in Trinidad. So I'm a little puzzled by that.
Frankly, you can join AUSA Hagee on that. He, I think, has found it unfortunate that I did concede that in my brief and has brought that up repeatedly. In that respect, I just didn't think it was a battle worth fighting. I had a clear error finding from a district court judge who was there on the scene.
Clear error on
initiation.
Initiation, that's not really a pure factual question. I mean, it is in a case where, you know, the question is, did the defendant speak first or did the police speak first? But I would understand that to be subject to the same kind of sort of hybrid standards of review that one would use in a reasonable suspicion or probable cause or, you know, other kind of situation where, I mean, we have to make a legal determination of whether what was said and what's in the record counts as initiation for Edward purposes, don't we?
I've cited two cases where it's found joint initiation is a finding.
Which I would distinguish on the basis that I just indicated.
Okay, number one. Number two, take for example consent, Schneckloth. Was somebody's will overborne? Legal question. Facts are developed. The Supreme Court has clearly said that's clearly erroneous. I would put this in that category.
Okay. Thank you. Does Mr. Kirsch have any time left?
Yes.
You can take 2 minutes.
Yes, thank you.
And would you start with this question of the district court's finding based on context? He said, when viewed in context, this message is sufficient to evidence a willingness to talk.
I completely disagree with that, and I believe that
But you agree that's what the district court said?
I agree that's what he said, and I disagree with the validity of what Judge Bates said, and I believe that...
But is that a factual finding? How do we review that?
I think about that for a second, but I believe it is a factual finding.
Yeah, so, which I'm using challenge.
No, because, well, it is clearly erroneous, and it's a clearly erroneous analysis of the law.
Okay, well, what about his point that we have to look at this in context?
The only context is what I would submit to the court is what Mr. Straker said to what, quote-unquote, initiate contact. What happened at that point in time, which...
You mean in the phone message?
The phone message.
You don't think we should look beyond the phone message?
No, I really don't, because, again...
Well, what other reason might he have been asking for a callback?
He could have been, as Judge Bates made very clear in his opinion, because there was one point in time when Mr. Straker had an outburst in court and started yelling about something, and Judge Bates relied on that in saying that, well, I believe Mr. Straker is very apt at expressing himself. Mr. Straker could have been talking about anything. He could have been calling Freeman about absolutely anything. If we remember, go back to the context, he was having a conversation with the FBI agent saying to them, well, one of them, you look like my father. Maybe you can find my natural father. I haven't seen him in years. Maybe he was calling about that. We just don't know. Uh-huh. And we're talking about overcoming this very strong presumption. I would submit that the speculation doesn't work. But I do want to just address Schatzer very briefly. Mm-hmm. Both Schatzer and Isaac versus Head, which the government relies on, neither of those cases is controlling in this context, in this case, because both in Schatzer and in Isaac, the defendant was serving a prison sentence. He was convicted and serving a prison sentence before the second interview commenced. And that is the key distinction. Straker was not serving a sentence in this case. And Judge Scalia, who wrote the opinion in Maryland versus Schatzer, he talked about that extensively, that because he put in this 14-day bright line rule and said, well, that's because the person's serving a sentence and he goes back to a familiar circumstance, and so the problem with coercion is lessened. Straker was not serving a sentence. He was being held for 18 months, and I submitted to the court as part of this record the country reports detailing the atrocious conditions in that prison where Straker was being held indefinitely, as far as he knew, while he was waiting to be extradited to the United States. So I would submit that Schatzer and Isaac do not apply to
that. Does it not make a difference that the FBI was not responsible for the conditions detailed in those country reports and was not, in fact, the sovereign that was holding him during those 18 months?
I don't think it matters in the context of the Edwards analysis. I really don't. And I agree, the FBI, they put him wherever they're going to put him. But I think that under the Edwards analysis and under the Schatzer analysis, I think that the conditions that he was held in is significant, A, because it was pretrial, and B, because they were deplorable conditions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. On behalf of the court, I want to thank all counsel who appeared here this morning for your arguments. You've been focused and responsive to the court, and we will take the case under advisement. Thank you.